And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Erwin Aronson, going to be here talking about the attacks on public education and some of the backdoor stuff the Republicans were trying to do today. Fortunately, most of it's been thwarted to this point, but understand, the attacks will come. They will come fast. They will come furious. Bet your bottom dollar they are not giving up on privatizing public education. They are not giving up. Understand that. Short setback, but they are going to, at some point down the road, they are going to extract their 10 or 20 or 100 pounds of flesh. It is going to happen, I think, unless you stand up, unless, you know, average everyday citizens call your legislators, say, hey, leave my school alone. Fix the ones that need help. Fix the ones that are not doing so well. Focus on those 144 that they're saying are failing. Leave the other 3,100 alone. They're doing all right. There's a good idea. Maybe just to start. In the second hour, we're going to talk to our good friend Scott Conklin, Pennsylvania State Representative, about the budget, about a number of things. You look at, there's just so much here to get involved in. They're going to have to at some point start talking about heading up a health exchange. What's that going to look like? A couple other states are kind of fighting back and forth whether they're going to do it. We'll talk a little bit about that with Scott. This budget, understand, budget just passed, the Pennsylvania state budget, $27.15 billion, $150 million under what Corbett had proposed. As draconian as that budget was, this one's even worse. Understand, this is the Republican baby. This is theirs. Bottom line. We'll talk about that. Also, Arthur Stamlozzi is going to be here. From Citizens Trade Campaign. He's the executive director over there. CitizenTrade.org is the website. We're going to talk about these trade agreements. And the president again, and the Democrats pushing these insane trade agreements. And, it's just mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling that at a time like now. But I guess, they've done a sufficient job of hammering home this idea that, you know what? These free trade agreements create jobs. Look how well NAFTA did for us. Look at the millions of manufacturing jobs. Bye-bye. All gone. So what we're left, some industry left. And then as states, we're fighting over those. And in Washington, what they're talking about, massive pain again. This state budget, horrible. Destructive, painful, and we're going to see it. Your property taxes are going to go up. They're going to go after that. But, when we talk with our friend Erwin, he's going to talk about how they're trying to go through the back door to make sure that doesn't happen, so that the real pain is on the backs of the children. But we'll talk about that later. You look at Greece right now. And Greece, I think, is a good example of what's going on in this country and across the globe, really. They just passed their austerity measures through the parliament there in Greece. And you've got people out in the street saying, there are better ways of doing this. Maybe stop some of the corruption. Maybe stop some of the tax cheating that's going on. Maybe stop pandering to the very, very wealthy. And it's a lesson I think we should be learning as well. Because all I keep hearing about in D.C. is how we need to cut, how we need to cut, and we need to sacrifice, of course, and how it's going to be painful. But we have to do it now. So we have to cut Social Security, we have to cut Medicare, we have to cut Medicaid. We're going to give Medicaid block grants to the states so that they can decide how to use the money best. Like by cutting people off of the system, like in Arizona, the guy yesterday we talked about for $12. Because he collected Social Security, $12 too much. He cannot get Medicaid. And he can't give the $12 back. That's the other travesty of the situation. So no Medicaid. So in this country, again, he needs heart surgery. In this country, no health care, you die. And it really steamrolls down. No job, no health care. No health care, you die. except for that little, you know, little side thing there with Medicaid, which the Republicans are working very hard and diligently at destroying. And on the state level, if you're talking about giving that Medicaid money or giving big block grants, let the states decide, laboratories, yeah. What happens when you've got a legislature like we've got across, like we've got here in Harrisburg? Who, well, we're gonna use that money for something else. Tax breaks for corporations, that's right. Handouts for the drilling industry. We're gonna leave that loophole open. In fact, we're gonna make sure that those companies can go over there, we're gonna help them pay for it. I mean, it's getting that insane. It is just nuts. And I read the Patriot News today, which, you know, is a right-wing newspaper, in my opinion. I don't care what anybody says. The editorial board wrote when the Patriot News endorsed Tom Corbett for governor in October, they said, we wrote, the bottom line on his success will be how the new governor balances the budget without significant tax increases. Well, he did that. Him and his co-governor, Grover Norquist, they took the little pledge, they got the pledge through, and they've held to it. No new taxes. And they say, well, he delivered on his campaign promise, and, you know, they went and they did a lot of things, and they've delivered on the budget, and they roll through this whole beautiful, rosy scenario. Oh, it's just, you know, he did what he said he was going to do, got a lot of help from the Republican-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate. I mean, even they admit, this is the Republicans' baby. So you get about two-thirds way through the article. And that's when they start going, but here's the problem. Yeah, they did this. And they write, it's obvious who's to blame for this. It's obvious when tuitions go up because they cut funding to the state-related school universities and class sizes start to go up. People are going to know who to blame. The Republicans. This is their budget. They control the entire process. And when you got these K through 12 budget cuts, when local communities are going, like Harrisburg here, we got to lay off 214 people. We got to close four schools. People are going to look and go, it was the Republicans who did this. At least that's my hope. And they say the cuts to public welfare were expected. Long-term care funding was hit severely, as well as other programs such as child care assistance that are critical to enable mothers to work. They say this might prove short-sighted. So they say we've got to hold on taxes. Whoa, congratulations, Tom. Congratulations, Republicans. You have done what you said you were going to do. You didn't raise taxes. You cut spending. Well, where did you doofuses think the spending cuts were going to come from? Did you think that there was, as the Republicans kept saying, a big gold door with waste, fraud, and abuse on it, where there was a big hole in the middle of the room behind that door where people were just shoveling tax dollars into and burning it? So they go through and they say, look, you know, class sizes are going to go up. Tuition's going to go up. We're going to see a lot of people who are going to struggle. There are going to be a lot of people long-term care people gonna get screwed in this. Mothers who need child care assistance gonna get screwed in this. So, you know, look at the mothers with the child care assistance. What's gonna happen? They're gonna end up losing their jobs, ending up back on welfare, and public welfare is gonna go through the roof again. Real brilliant. And they go, oh, this might prove short-sighted. Do you think? Really? Do you think, Patriot News? Do you think it's short-sighted? And then they go on to say the biggest criticism, no movement on the Marcellus Shale. The drillers appear likely to get off the hook. And they will. I mean, the Republicans will put some kind of a shadow in there where it looks like, oh, we tried, and they're going to pay something. It's going to be nothing. You and I are going to end up with massive bills piled up as we go forward. Because there's no oversight. They cut the EPA budget. At a time when you need it the most, they decide to cut the EPA's budget. Anyway, the Patriot News writes, it remains a black mark on Pennsylvania politics. It's not going to go away. In fact, the need to deal with more continues to grow the more we learn about the potential problems of extracting the natural gas. Do you think the more needles they put in the ground, the more stories we hear of accidents and explosions, leaks, the more we hear about this. And look, we're just hearing about a number of instances. We're not hearing about all of it. But here's the thing, and this is where they finish up. This is a victory for the governor and the Republicans. This is the first time since 2002 that the budget will not only be done on time, but will be leaner without tax increases. So they're all giddy, all tingly in the panties that there are no tax increases, but they admit they cut education funding, they cut higher education funding, they cut the social spending on granny who needs someone to come into the house every once in a while, check on her. Now you're going to push her into a nursing home. Folks who are severely disabled, they're going to struggle more. And what the Republicans have done a masterful job of doing is saying, well, you know, the welfare budget is, the public welfare budget is so big. Doesn't take into account that you're taking care of granny in the nursing homes. You're taking care of the disabled. You're taking care of a lot of people. Not the mythical welfare queen they keep throwing out there, but people who are screwed. And what do? They pass that joint and several bill so that you and I are going to pick up more people under public welfare because they're not going to be able to sue people who are at fault. I mean, it's really, if it wasn't so perverted, I would laugh. I would think it's just a bad comedy. But you and I are going to get stuck with this. We're going to get screwed. This budget is going to harm us for at least a generation. And the Republicans are giddy because they're saying, this is step one. We got next year. We're going to go get them some more. And I love the quote by one of the Representative Mustio. This is just priceless.
This is a teachable moment for all of our students on how to live within your means and not become whiners.
Yeah. This is a teachable moment, our Republican friend says, on how not to become whiners. Live within your means. Suck it up like what they used to back in the 1800s and when they were men and they starved. Brian Ellis, another Republican.
Now, I heard a colleague on the other side mention that this budget is actually going to cost Pennsylvania jobs. I disagree.
He disagrees. The cuts in funding to the public welfare, those people who used to have to go to folks' homes and check on them, those jobs aren't going anywhere. The fact that we're slashing the budget, 214 teachers here in Harrisburg, out in the street. And we're seated all across the state, laying off hundreds of teachers, thousands. Not going to cost jobs, though, according to Representative Ellis. Tells you where his head's at, straight up his keister. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, right back after this.
America. Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers, the Teamsters, and the AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department are all weighing in against the proposed free trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia. The Teamsters say that these NAFTA-style trade agreements have cost nearly 2 million American jobs, and these proposed agreements just continue the trend. The United Steelworkers say these three agreements will undermine our economic recovery and further decimate American manufacturing. The AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department says the deals will contribute to the erosion of America's industrial base and are disastrous for construction workers. 800,000 federal workers could end up furloughed if Congress fails to move forward on an increase of the debt ceiling. Jesse Russell reports.
That's according to a study conducted by George H.W. Bush's former Treasury Undersecretary, Jay Powell, who crunched the numbers with assistance from Bill Clinton's former budget director, Alice Rivlin, and retired Senate Budget Committee Chairman, Republican Pete Domenici. The study, released Tuesday, reveals the U.S. government would be unable to fund 50% of its obligations. The federal government would need to implement an immediate cut of 44% in federal spending. Impacted departments include Veterans Affairs, Labor, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Education, and others. Military pay would also likely be on the chopping block. Powell told reporters that the end result would be chaotic. Republican presidential candidate and Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann has dismissed any talk of not raising the debt ceiling as being dangerous for the country as nothing more than President Barack Obama using scare tactics.
Harsh state budget cuts have been pushed by Republicans with the claim that cutting will grow the economy and jobs. Economist Adam Hirsch at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, though, says that data shows that's not true. In fact, states that increased their spending have seen more economic growth, lower unemployment, and more jobs creation. Hirsch looked at 24 states that cut spending and 25 that expanded government spending by an average of 11%. Hirsch says that states that increased spending on average showed a 1.4% rise in private employment, lower joblessness, and a half percentage point of real economic growth. States that cut spending on average saw a 1% hike in unemployment, a 2.1% drop in private employment, and a 2.9% real economic contraction rather than growth. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
All the things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
So just here, I guess within the last hour or so, the House voted 109 to 92. $27.2 billion budget. Two Republicans crossed the line from insanity to sane. Denny O'Brien and John Taylor, both Republicans in the Philadelphia area, but the rest were on the Corbett train. Sad day. This is going to be. I think these cuts are going to be felt for at least a generation, as I've said. But here again, this isn't the last attack. There are a number coming down the road. This whole privatization scheme, this whole let's destroy public education, that's moving down the track as well. Here to talk to us a little bit about that is our good friend attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us, brother.
Good to hear your voice. It's a tough time up here, Rick.
I got to tell you, you know, they say elections have consequences. This is the consequence of people staying home.
This is a consequence of the inmates running the asylum. It is certainly a consequence of people staying home. People were disenchanted November last year over the dynamic and the intersection, if you will, of their hopes from the 2008 election and their reality in the 2 years subsequent to that. And they couldn't bring themselves to vote against or for the people who were spouting off all these platitudes, so they stayed home, and those people got elected anyway, and here we are.
Well, you know, you go back to the November election, November of 10, and all of the discussion that was going on, we need to cut, without any specifics. We now know, and I'm talking to a couple of my friends who were on that we need to cut government spending stuff. They were on that bandwagon, now looking at the cuts going, what, cutting education? What, cutting funding for the nursing home that my grandmother's in? What? That's not what I wanted, but it's what we got.
Well, it's what they got for us, and that's the problem. Special ed students, seniors, children particularly who are living below the poverty level in families around Pennsylvania are going to pay the price for somebody else's arrogance and folly. And I think you're right when you say we're going to feel this for a generation. It will be a generation or more because we're going to have an undereducated generation of children who will not be able to qualify for the high-demand, high-tech jobs that are off in the future because they will not have been equipped by a public education system that will have failed them in order to protect the Marcellus Shale operators from having to pay any extraction tax, in order to protect big businesses operating in Pennsylvania and slipping through the Delaware loophole, in order for us to evade our fundamental responsibility to our children, to our environment, and to our future. And the people who caused this will ultimately get the punishment, but in the meantime, a whole lot of innocent people are going to really be punished. And they haven't come off the last punishment yet from the economic collapse. And here we are doing it to them again, and this time we're not doing it to merely their present. We're dealing it to all of our future.
You know, I look at this and I say this is exactly what we've done to the infrastructure, the roads, the bridges in our country. We failed to invest in them for years and years. We're heading down the same path by not funding, not investing in education, and I fear, much like our crumbling infrastructure, education down the road will see the same things. And, you know, as we're talking about this, there was some discussion today, some backdoor dealing around Act One. I was hoping you'd be able to clarify some of that for us.
Well, the dealing is going on as we speak. I wish I knew better, but it appears as if there are going to be some amendments to Act One that will, among other things, even place such critical issues as special education as expenditure, special education spending in school districts, before voters for approval. So these people who are the most helpless, the children who need us most, will have to rely on the greed-based determinations of voters in a particular school district in order to get the funding for their educational needs that is so fundamentally needed. You have no reason to know what I'm going to tell you next, and the listeners certainly don't. My daughter, Lauren, is a speech-language pathologist. She works with the most profoundly affected children in our society, autistic children who, in addition to autism, all have some other issue, whether it's cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy, or a plethora of terrible diseases that affect our children. And she works with kids who, in the course of a year, if she can really be effective and they utter an intelligible syllable after a year of her intense work with them, that is enormous progress. And it is those very children right now whose futures are being carved up in the General Assembly while we're chatting on your radio show. And I spoke to my daughter a couple of hours ago, and she's in tears because she understands with crystal clarity on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, moment-by-moment basis what it means to her kids. And that's the impact of the amendatory language on Act One that is being debated right now in behind closed doors, in back rooms somewhere in the recesses of the Capitol building, in ways that we don't get to hear, and certainly not under the light of sunshine or under the scrutiny of the public, or perish the thought, pursuant to the subject of a public hearing in the legislature in the people's house.
You see, you lay that out, and that is, you know, it's just one of those heart-wrenching stories. You lay that out. Is it that these folks who are doing this don't know it or don't care?
I think it is certainly not that they don't care. It is that they are distant. They're distant from the reality of life. They live in this rarefied atmosphere inside the Capitol building where being a member of the General Assembly is a really good job with good pay and a car allowance and a per diem and a clerical staff and offices with richly paneled walls and fancy fireplaces. And they get removed from the reality of day-to-day life. And that's certainly not all of them. It may not even be a majority of them. I listened shortly before we got together on the show this evening to some of the debate over the budget, and there were member after member of the House of Representatives before the vote that you made reference to who talked about the really, really fundamental impact on their districts. A representative from Luzerne County who noted that unlike some of the wealthier districts like Mount Lebanon in Allegheny County or Camp Hill in Cumberland County or some of the more plush districts on the main line in Philadelphia or in Bucks County, in his district, something in excess of 17% of the children in public schools live below the poverty level. And he knew and passionately articulated what it means to those children. But in the end, we have this constitutional deadline, and somehow the deadline gets a life of its own, and June 30th becomes more significant than people. June 30th becomes more significant than our parents and their ability to have some dimension of independence in their declining years. More important, June 30th becomes than our children, who have a right to learn how to read, how to add, subtract, and multiply and divide, and to do so with facility. More than any number of things, this June 30 deadline looms, and we have a governor who has announced to us that what's paramount here is no new taxes, no old taxes, no more taxes, and we got to get it done by June 30th no matter what. And it's not satisfactory to pass a slash-and-burn-ripper budget, we have to also pass these ancillary bills, bills that do things like amending Act 1 and place before voters the idea that they should have to weigh in on every public expenditure associated with schools, but that they don't get the right to weigh in when those same school districts are being compelled to issue charters and take away money from the public school system to finance charter schools. There's no vote on that by the taxpayers. And there's no vote by the taxpayers on what the governor's pay ought to be. And there's no vote by taxpayers on how much we expend on frivolous activity or passing out whams, walking around money to corporate structures that don't need the money. And there's no discussion about how we're renting out at a free price so much land that Pennsylvania owns in the north central and western part of the states of the state to eviscerate our land and to really rape yet again the forests and the grounds of Pennsylvania to extract Marcellus shale so that a bunch of people can get even richer while they bring in workers from Texas and Oklahoma to steal our jobs.
Yeah. You know, the reason I asked about them either not knowing or not caring is I had, you know, I was listening to the same discussion you were, and Representative Mustio said this.
This is a teachable moment for all of our students on how to live within your means and not become whiners.
And, you know, I listen to that and I go, does he not care? I mean, this is a teachable moment. Don't be a whiner. Suck it up.
Well, that would be fine if we were teaching children to live within their means. We're teaching children to live within somebody else's unilaterally imposed means. This is, after all, a democracy. Democracy doesn't mean that I have a right to tell you how to live. Democracy doesn't mean that I have a right to get mine and ignore you. And Mark Mustio is someone who I know and I have worked around in the legislature for many years. He is not an indecent human being. He is not a callous person. But at some point, the political reality of the jingoistic drumbeat overtakes the more fundamental reality of people. And that's the problem we are facing in the heat of this particular moment, Rick. And it is a sad day. And if my voice sound sad and in my nature sound subdued, it's because I hurt tonight. I hurt tonight for all the people whose kitchen tables I've sat at when the plant was closing, and try to work through how we were going to get from where they were to paying next week's rent bill when the first of the month comes around. I fear that we have reached a point where those who depend on our government, on their own government, to do the things for them that they can't do for themselves have become mere statistics, just numbers, and not live, warm people, not people in wheelchairs, not people who are intelligent, have intelligent children, who merely with a little bit of nurturing and a little bit of quality education could be the person that invents the cure for cancer, or who invents the method by which we get off of fossil fuels and onto something else in some meaningful, renewable way. And it is that investment that we're not about to make, that we are about to deny, that denies young people today a future in this state.
I got to tell you, though, Irwin, here's the thing. And I hear it in your right. I hear it in your voice. You're the sad and this somber moment. Me, I'm pissed off. I'm angry. My three children, and I've got young children. What is their future going to be? Are they going to be saddled in classes with 40, 50 kids where they're packed into a room that they can't even trip over each other in? What's it going to mean for their future? What's it going to mean, if heaven forbid something happens, to me or to my wife, and they need some assistance and it's not there? That's what I'm angry about.
Well, you have every reason to be angry. I'm angry too. But right now I think I'm sad and subdued because I have spent, as you know, this week 39 years at this, and I've never seen anything like this before, and I've never been at a time where I wasn't able to roll my sleeves up and with the good grace of my many clients who have entree that from time to time gets me in a door to be their advocate and be their voice. This time I haven't been able to accomplish it, and my heart's a little sore right now. I'll be angry tomorrow, but tonight I'm hurting. I'm hurting because I do understand, and I do empathize, and I do sympathize with what I see coming next. And I still have enough of that Pollyanna in me that I don't look at this in raw political terms. I look at this instead in human terms. And I'm looking for a day that will be brighter, not a day that is dimmer yet.
So the end of this, as we move down the road, this is, and it's going to I'm going to be drum beating this until next election, until the election after that, that what they have done is the Republicans doing solely, without any input, without any discussion from the other side of the aisle. And, you know, only two Republicans voted against this bill, Denny O'Brien and John Taylor. That's it. All the other Republicans on that side, lockstep. This is their baby.
Well, this is clearly their budget, and I think that maybe a bit unlike you, I don't see this any longer in terms of Democratic and Republican decision-making. The people of Pennsylvania installed the elected leaders we have. They did so by their votes. They did so by staying home. They did so by their acquiescence. And this is not about Democrats and Republicans, because it wasn't merely the Democrats that weren't at the table. Children weren't at the table. Their advocates weren't at the table. Workers weren't at the table. Their advocates and their representatives were not at the table. Senior citizens were not at the table. Their representatives and their advocates were not at the table. They're disabled. Were not at the table, and their representatives were not at the table. A whole swath of critical, large numbers of dependable, realistic, upright, committed Pennsylvanians were denied access to the table. Yup, it's easy to say that in a political sense and in a political nature that Democrats were cut out, and this is a Republican budget, and certainly it is their baby, and they're going to have to live with it, they're going to have to explain it, and if somehow, by the grace of God, this plan works and turns things around, they're entitled to the credit. And if it doesn't, they're entitled to the blame. And you, I hope, and I, hopefully with your good nature, will allow me to hammer it and hammer it and hammer it. But the real hammer has to be and must be a recognition of what this does to people. This is not banking 101. This isn't a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon we're talking about real money. This is reality. This is families that depend upon help from their government to pay their winter utility bills. This is about children who have learning disabilities that are entitled to be mainstreamed and to have a platform for education that reaches them, and they're not intellectually deficient. They learn differently. They're learning differences, not learning disabilities. But we have cut them out, and we have said that they are going to have to depend on the people that live in their school district who often don't use the schools, who often have children who are out of school, who have children that can, you know, live in families that can afford to send their children to private or parochial schools. They're going to have to depend on those people to vote in favor of their needs. And that is creating a divide in society, a wedge in society, a clash between competing interests in society. My interest in saving money and your interest in my paying to help your kids. And that is never a good recipe. I think that you had a commercial, one of your sponsors, not a true commercial, but one of your sponsors, the American Federation of Teachers, message on shortly before I came onto this segment of the show that talked about some statistics that I had heard earlier today. In every single state in which budget cutting has taken place, unemployment numbers have gone up, actual employment rolls have gone down. In the states that courageously didn't do that slashing, unemployment numbers have gone down and employment rolls have gone up. Them's the facts.
Yep. And we've talked about that a couple of times here since that report came out, and the reality is now we're going to see where Pennsylvania goes with this. We're going to see.
I've lived in Pennsylvania every day of my life, and I love this state. It's beautiful countryside. It's wonderful people. It's breathtaking mountains, and it's wonderful forests, and we're strafing them all right now. We're strafing them. We're investing in Marcellus Shale. We're not investing in state parks.
But now is not the time, and this is what I want people to understand. Now is not the time to give up. Now is the time to engage.
Oh, now is clearly the time, the most opportune time to engage. Elected officials, regardless of their party, have made a decision. They need to be responsible for that decision. Just like Mark Mustio said, this is a learning moment. This is a teachable moment. And we are all going to learn. The learning, I suspect, will be rather painful, and it will disproportionately affect those who need us the most. But that having been said, it is, I agree, a teachable moment.
Like the one woman in the wheelchair when they had the protest here at the governor's office. She says, if I'm going to die, if he's going to kill me, I'm going to do it in public.
Yep. I think that we all need to do this in public. Our job from this moment forward, through and including the very next general election day, is going to be to hold up a mirror to the General Assembly of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Hold up a mirror to Governor Corbett. Hold up a mirror to everybody who, through the demagoguery and through the political pandering, has got us to this point, and make them see themselves and allow everybody to see them for what they are and make their choices. And if the majority of the people in this state say that this was the right choice, I, like all of us, will be bound by it because I believe in our democracy. But if, perish the thought, people are affected in the way I anticipate, and my colleagues anticipate they're going to be affected by this draconian series of measures, by this rank political opportunism, by this follow-the-money politics, then they, too, will understand that they were responsible for that result as well. And if we're going to elect, we got to be able to collect. And if they deny us the ability and the right to collect what is ours and redistribute wealth, just as they say they are against, by confiscating it from the poor and confiscating it from the needy and confiscating it from the underprivileged and confiscating it from the unemployed and underemployed, and to put it in the hands of the rich guys, put it in the hands of the big boys, with this silly idea that if you feed the elephants, the sparrows will ultimately eat. We will have to speak on the next election day loud and clear and forcefully. And that's the message for today, and that's the message for tomorrow, and that's the message for every day that we live and breathe between now and the next opportunity we have to vote.
Now, the campaign has begun. Irwin, always great talking to you. Somber night, but again, like I said, the fight begins. Appreciate your time, brother.
Thank you. Appreciate yours. Keep at it. Keep telling the story. Get the truth out. That's what matters.
All righty. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What do you think of this budget? Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It turns out that the rich are not so different from you and me, for we're all filled with anxiety. You and I are scared by what they're doing to our middle-class future, and they're scared of what we might do to them for what they're doing to us. The really, really richy rich, for example, are going to the dogs, literally, but they're not getting pooches at the adopt-a-pet shelter. Instead, shopping in the high-end guard dog market. This elite canine crowd is paying up to $400,000 for, quote, an executive protection dog. As I said, these are nervous people. The New York Times reports that one fellow who is wallowing in wealth laid out $230,000 for his exec protect dog, and he flies her by private jet between his Arizona and Minnesota mansions. He now has six of these security hounds, taking a couple of them with him in his car every time he goes out. Then there are some swells who fear that even a pack of attack dogs won't be enough if there's a mass uprising of knocked-down commoners. So they're seeking shelter to ride out any storm, paying as much as $20 million each. They're buying luxury doomsday bunkers. One of these retreats for elites, now being built under Nebraska grasslands, is practically big enough to have its own zip code. This project by Vivos, Inc. offers four levels of individual suites, medical and dental clinics, a fully stocked wine cellar, pool hall, its own little jail, and, just in case the worst comes, a prayer room. And yes, there are kennels if you feel the need to bring your executive protection dogs with you. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this fear would dissipate if these rich ones would simply join the rest of us to restore shared prosperity to our economy. As President John Kennedy put it, if a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I look at this budget and it just, oh man, the words that I could come up with. But again, what this is going to do. This is going to, for generations, harm our education system. For generations, it's going to harm the poor and the needy. And for generations, it's going to harm the middle class, the working class. But that has been the Republican way for quite some time. And there's a piece over at Mother Jones that I pulled a clip out of. Their July, August 2011 bit called All Work and No Pay, The Great Speed Up by Monica Bauerlein and Clara Jeffrey. They write, quote, for 90% of American workers, incomes have stagnated or fallen for the past three decades, while they've ballooned at the very top and exploded at the very tippy top. By 2008, the wealthiest 0.1% were making 6.4 times as much as they did just in 1980. In other words, they write, all the extra work that you've taken on, the late nights, the skipped lunch hours, the missed soccer games, well, they paid off for them, not for you. Amazing stuff. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Susie on line one. How are you doing tonight, Susie?
Hi, Rick. I'm mad as hell, Rick. Mad as hell.
That's the proper response, in my opinion.
I don't know if you saw that part of this is that they've cut the staffing and program for DEP.
Yep.
So that they make sure they don't have enough people to supervise the Marcellus Shale wells. I'm just so furious. I mean, clearly this Republican Governors Association is the organizing mechanism where all of these seemingly mild-mannered Republicans who didn't talk to the press and didn't really give policy statements, all of a sudden, you know, as soon as they're sworn in, they come out of the gate and bam.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this past weekend. They had the big powwow there in Colorado with the Koch brothers.
Oh yeah.
Again, you know, this is all tied into that. This is, you know, when people say, well, you know, we're going to be independent. No, our governors are bought and paid for, like you said, by the Republican Governors Association, who's basically bought and paid for by the billionaire class,
yeah,
by the Kochs of the world.
Yep. And you know, I was sitting in a little local restaurant tonight. And this woman was talking to me, and, you know, she's not a very educated woman, and she's not a well-to-do woman. She turns around and she said to me, you know, you have to wonder at what point people are just going to pull out their guns and start shooting these bastards. And I couldn't argue with her.
It's a question I get quite frequently on the program. You know, when do we have the French Revolution? When do we start going scouring the towers, scouring the walls of the gated communities?
Sometimes I think the only thing that will get things going is for somebody to go around and cut all the cable TV.
Oh, but then we would miss American Idol.
Yeah, I know. Imagine.
Well, bread and circus, you know, you keep people mildly entertained and semi-fed, and they'll never rise up.
Well, I'm going around to my Republican state senator's office tomorrow, who just lives right around the block, and I never voted for him. You know, it was funny because when I moved here, some of the local Democrats said, oh, he's a nice guy, and, you know, we support him, and you should vote for him, and I just thought over my dead body, so I never voted for him. But I'm going to go over there tomorrow, and I'm going to give his staffers a piece of my mind. I'm going to put the fear of God into those people.
And what needs to happen is you need to go, your neighbors need to go, and you need to have a whole bunch of people who go. And I'm hoping at some point, I'm hoping tomorrow when people open up the newspaper and start to see the massive, draconian, painful cuts that are coming down the road, maybe they come to Harrisburg, and they do like they did in Wisconsin. Maybe just a thought.
I doubt it. Well, the other thing is, you know, we're a lot bigger, aren't we, than Wisconsin?
Similar.
We are similar?
We're wider.
We're very wide,
They're higher.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't know. I think people don't have the money for gas.
No, they've gotten into our pockets, all right.
But they have all these satellite offices everywhere, you know, and people need to go to them because, you know what? I would say it would be a really good thing if their staffers told their bosses that they were scared to death now.
Yeah, I mean, all of the folks who voted for these people, and even the ones who didn't, should be lighting up the phones tomorrow morning. Your local rep, call their local office, light up the phones early, often. You know, even call the guy in the next county over. Call a bunch of people. Say, this isn't what we voted for. Because, look, and I've talked to a couple of friends who, you know, they're all in favor of cuts. They think that there's this big office somewhere in the Capitol. It's a gold-plated door with waste, fraud, and abuse stenciled in gold letters on it. There's a big pit where they just, you know, pitch all of our money and burn it. There's not.
They don't understand that the real waste, fraud, and abuse is the stuff we'll never touch. You know, the pinstripe patronage, like the bond deals and the insurance contracts.
Yep.
They'll never touch that stuff.
And all the handouts that we give to corporations. All the
exactly.
Tax loopholes and all of the looking the other way with some regulations. Like last night we talked to the folks from Metropolis, Illinois. They had, I think it was 17 serious OSHA violations, a mere $119,000 in fines. That's not even worth fixing the problem
for. Oh,
yeah.
They just consider that part of the cost of doing business now.
It's just
a slap on the wrist. They don't really pay for anything.
It's just nuts.
You know, all I can say is, this is just astounding. It's just astounding to me. And I know that where I live, the neighborhood in Philadelphia where I live is a largely union area. And, you know, I really hope that we're going to see some pushback from the local unions when they realize what happened today.
Yeah, and again, you know, tomorrow and today, tomorrow, when they come back, we're still going to be talking about privatizing education. These folks are not going to stop. They've got the power. They are going to ram through every one of the little whispering fantasies they had in their little think tanks. Everything that gets their panties all in a tingle, they're going after.
Yep, the wish list.
Yep. Susie, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much.
Keep up the good work.
I'm ticked off with you. And, you know, you can have no other response than to be really, viscerally ticked off over this. And it's one of these things, you knew it was coming. You knew it was coming, Jake. You absolutely knew this was going to pass. There was no question about it. But you had hoped at some point that there would be some rational folks who said, hold on. We got some real problems. There's some additional revenue that's come in. We can offset some of those problems with a little. We can work something out.
Well, anger is a powerful, powerful emotion, and we hope that people get angry and stay angry and feed off of that. And I still do believe, and we said it last night. I said it. I'm sure you concur. The Republicans will pay a price. Will pay a price, and we have to make sure that they do. And we have to make sure that we never again fail to come out and vote. This is what happens.
And you know what gets me? They've passed this budget that really just slashes a bunch of boatload of money from education. And now they're working on going back and fixing the law so that even if your local community says, you know what, I'm willing to raise my taxes to make up the difference. I don't want 214 teachers from my school district to get fired. I don't want 50 kids in the classroom. I want to have a good school in our neighborhood so that my property values are increased. Because understand, if you've got a good, high-rated school, you know what happens? Your property taxes go up. Your property taxes, I mean, your property value goes way up. And your property taxes go up a little bit as well. And you pay for the school and you pay for the environment. That's smart because you want people coming in with children who are going to want that. What they're trying to do is they're going to try and make it that where even if you wanted to increase your property taxes locally, that you're only going to be able to do so a certain amount. And no more. So if they gut your funding, and this has been going on for years, you know, back when I went to the local school board where I lived to complain about class size, you know, the guy was very nice, you know, basically told me it's not going to happen, you're out of luck. But he said, look, you know, at the end of this, our problem is not, you know, class size, our problem is money. We every year keep getting cuts from the state. Every year they keep walking away from their responsibility and pushing it down on the local economy, and we just can't afford it. So again, what they're going to try and do, they're going to strip more money from the local schools, and they're going to handcuff them to not be able to raise more. I mean, if you really stop and think about their ideology, their ethos, their worldview of, you know, local, let the local alone. We should leave local autonomy to itself. What they're trying to do is take that away. I mean, it's really a destruction of their worldview. Now, they see it as, well, we're just protecting the taxpayers. What they're doing is they're pandering to Governor Grover Norquist, you know, the co-governor. Because we got two. Fortunately for us in Pennsylvania, we're so lucky that we've got an elected governor and an elected co-governor. And you know, Grover's kind of like the guy who sits on Tom Corbett's shoulder, kind of looks over him, says, "That money that came in, don't worry about that. That money that drilling money, don't worry about that. That's a tax. We don't want to go after that. That loophole where all the profits are leaving the state, you can't touch that because that would be an additional tax. That would break your pledge." And I go back to the going down to the crossroads where you sold your soul to the devil. And you can't break the contract with the devil. This is what's happened. He has signed his name on the dotted line, and he is now beholden 100% to someone who doesn't live in this state. The heck with you, the heck with your children, the heck with your grandmother, the heck with the family member who may be disabled and needs state care. Never mind them. We don't care about them. Because, you know, we need a teachable moment.
This is a teachable moment for all of our students on how to live within your means and not become whiners.
Whiners, yeah, we don't want those whiners. I mean, what is this teaching our children? And you know what's this? You know what this is teaching our kids? More of hooray for me and the heck with you. I got mine, screw you. That's what it's teaching. That's the teachable moment. The teachable moment is the winners and the losers. The winners, big corporations. The winners, out-of-state, big corporations. The losers, the middle class. The losers, children. The losers, people in poverty. Again, you know, when you start looking at this, who fills your campaign coffers? Big corporations. Who are the Republican Party folks beholden to, and a good portion of the Democrats? Don't get me wrong, Democrats are just as bad. Not in this case, though. The Democrats didn't even have a chance. So we don't know what they would have done. We really don't. I'm giving them a complete pass right now because they didn't have a say. They weren't even at the table. They weren't even allowed in the room. I don't even think they got to read the thing. They wouldn't even let them glimpse at the title page. The Republicans said, you know, we've got it. We're going to ram it through. It's ours. What's interesting to me is here we are, the 29th, and it's not done yet. I mean, they just voted on it. It hasn't been. I mean, if I were the Republicans, I'd have ran this through a month ago. Hey, we're efficient, man. We get things done. Scary times, folks. And when we come back in the next segment, we're going to talk with State Representative Scott Conklin. And I assume he's going to tell me what I've just told you, that they weren't even allowed in the room. They did their mandatory, okay, go ahead, Democrats, go say what you want to say, but we're not listening. We've already decided what's going to happen. You are not going to have a voice in it. Amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin, right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers, the Teamsters, and the AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department are all weighing in against the proposed free trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia. The Teamsters say that these NAFTA-style trade agreements have cost nearly 2 million American jobs, and these proposed agreements just continue the trend. The United Steelworkers say these three agreements will undermine our economic recovery and further decimate American manufacturing. The AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department says the deals will contribute to the erosion of America's industrial base and are disastrous for construction workers. 800,000 federal workers could end up furloughed if Congress fails to move forward on an increase of the debt ceiling. Jesse Russell reports.
That's according to a study conducted by George H.W. Bush's former Treasury Undersecretary, Jay Powell, who crunched the numbers with assistance from Bill Clinton's former budget director, Alice Rivlin, and retired Senate Budget Committee Chairman, Republican Pete Domenici. The study, released Tuesday, reveals the U.S. government would be unable to fund 50% of its obligations. The federal government would need to implement an immediate cut of 44% in federal spending. Impacted departments include Veterans Affairs, Labor, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Education, and others. Military pay would also likely be on the chopping block. Powell told reporters that the end result would be chaotic. Republican presidential candidate and Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann has dismissed any talk of not raising the debt ceiling as being dangerous for the country as nothing more than President Barack Obama using scare tactics.
Harsh state budget cuts have been pushed by Republicans with the claim that cutting will grow the economy and jobs. Economist Adam Hirsch at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, though, says that data shows that's not true. In fact, states that increased their spending have seen more economic growth, lower unemployment, and more jobs creation. Hirsch looked at 24 states that cut spending and 25 that expanded government spending by an average of 11%. Hirsch says that states that increased spending on average showed a 1.4% rise in private employment, lower joblessness, and a half percentage point of real economic growth. States that cut spending on average saw a 1% hike in unemployment, a 2.1% drop in private employment, and a 2.9% real economic contraction rather than growth. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm saying, like we were talking about with our friend attorney Irwin Aronson, this is a time now to get engaged, to get active. And I look at Ohio. Ohio passed SB 5, stealing collective bargaining rights away. Those people got out in the streets collecting signatures to overturn this law. They needed 231,149 signatures. Do you know how many they turned in? 1.3 million signatures. This is the kind of action, this is the kind of engagement that we need to have. We need people calling their representatives, calling their senators, and raising Cain. It's just that simple. I've got Pennsylvania State Representative Scott Conklin on the line. Scott, thanks for taking time for us, buddy. I know you're busy.
Rick, we're on the House floor right now. We just had the large, what's going to probably be the largest tax increase for local homeowners passed in the state of Pennsylvania. In my tenure down here, and while I'm talking to you, we're now debating the Grove Amendment, which will almost destroy public education, especially in fast-growing schools if it passes. So it's been one of those days. But you know, as we say, they can spend it however they want, Rick. The budget we pass today will be the largest property tax increase budget over the next years. The Corbett property tax increase is going to hurt working families more than anything there is.
Yeah, it's either going to harm taxpayers or it's going to harm children. Those are your choices. Do we screw the kids' future? Do they basically throw them to the wolves, or do we raise property taxes through the roof because your friends there in the House and in the Senate couldn't come together in a reasonable fashion?
Well, you know, Rick, over the last year, we've talked about this a lot. This is a 10 to 20 year plan. There's two ideas right now that is happening across the United States. And Corbett is part of that, you know, what's happening. He just came back from the governor's convention. He made it very clear that he does not like unions. And we've talked about this. This is a 10 to 20 year plan to do two things. Break the unions, destroy them, so there is no longer any money out there, that the rich control everything, and to destroy the public school system to make sure that they can sell it off and privatize it. Today, he has got step one and two in place. One, he just cut funding to schools, which is going to increase property taxes. But what we're arguing right now in the House for, why I'm talking to you, is the Grove Amendment. The Grove Amendment takes care of all the referendum, the back-end referendums, the increase for building, the increase for pension increases, the increase for things beyond our control. And they're making it so school districts cannot raise property taxes. Now, that sounds like a good thing. That sounds like a great thing. And, you know, we shouldn't have property taxes. But when you cut funding by $1 million to a small school district, when you cut it by $2 million to a small school district, and you're cutting their budget by 10, 12%, anywhere from 8 to 12 is the average cut rate now, now you're telling them that they can't raise property taxes above the 1.8. We have just lost your, and I know you're reading Allegheny County, Philadelphia, 200 teachers, Allegheny County, 143 at one school, 120 at another school. small little districts, 25. These are jobs, and these are killing our opportunity for education for our children. And this is a 10-year plan. By doing so, they're going to totally starve out the public school system to where people are going to get, they're going to be upset because their kids are no longer getting a good education. They're in bigger classrooms. There are less curriculum for them, and they're going to say, now we're going to privatize it. It's going to cost you more in the long run. Sorry I'm venting, but it's just been a long day.
No, I want angry because I got to tell you, I'm just flipping mad. I mean, we had our good friend Attorney Irwin Aronson on earlier, and he was very somber, and I want somebody who's just piss and vinegar. I want somebody who's angry and ready to rip somebody's throat out, which is why I got to tell you, I give you credit. I'd be in prison by now. They'd be locking me up.
Well, as I'm talking to you right now, I'm looking at my colleague, and we're arguing what should be a good thing to stop property taxes, but we're not stopping them because we're supporting public schools. We're trying to stop them because we're defunding public schools, and we want to make sure that they can't be on their feet. We are making sure that our children get a worse education than we had. We're making sure that there is no extracurricular activity. There's not going to be football. There's not going to be the arts. There's not going to be anything there, but hopefully the basics, and that is not going to prepare our children to compete against the rest of the world. And it's a long-term plan. It has done so very well. As somebody that was raised Republican, that's a good businessman, this is a model on how you destroy the competition. And I'm going to tell you right now, going into next year's election cycle for us, the other side is going to have millions upon millions of dollars, and they are choking off every penny we have of working people. And what's sad about it is that they hire me to make sure that their interests are taken care of. They don't have time to worry about these types of things. They have families to raise, and they are getting screwed, and please forgive me for using that, by what's happening today in Pennsylvania, and the folks won't even know it, and it's not their fault, but all they know is that in a few years their property taxes are going to go up, and their kids aren't going to get a good education, they're going to be mad, and they're not going to know who to blame, and they're going to blame the school teacher again because it's the easiest scapegoat.
And again, this is another attack on the middle class. I mean, the poor, I guess, are used to being poor, and they're used to getting kicked in the teeth, and they're used to being screwed over. But the folks in the middle, they're the ones who this is going to harm the most because, you know, we did want to pay property tax for our kids. We wanted them to live in an area with a good school. And now what you're saying is they're going to strangle that away from us. They're going to rip that away from us, ruin the value of our home, ruin the value of the education system in our school district. And on top of that, not give our kids the opportunity to compete in the next generation.
This is a long-term plan. You're going to see in the fall, the governor wants to get this through. You're going to see in the fall that the governor is going to bring the voucher system back again. I mean, when you even look at it, it takes money from public schools. It's only 5% of the failing schools. It's not going to help our kids, especially these legislators who represent rural Pennsylvania. And trust me, when I say rural, I'm talking everything outside of a few neighborhoods of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh that are going to lose money in their school district. And in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, what they're going to do is they're going to offer in Erie and in Harrisburg as well. They're going to be giving families hope. They're going to tell them that we're going to get your kid out of that bad school district. So vote for this. Vote for people who want these vouchers. They're going to get the vouchers, and there's going to be 1,000 kids, and only 5 of them are going to go to get to the school that they want to go to, and the rest of them are still going to be stuck there. They're going to break the promise to the poor who need it the most one more time. And again, this is a 10 to 20 year plan. This isn't an overnight plan. This is 10 to 20 years, and they're not going to give up until they get it, and they're putting everything in place. And the only thing I'm shocked about is how fast it's running through the state of Pennsylvania right now. I am absolutely shocked how quickly it's running through.
I got to be honest with you. I don't think it's a 10 or 20 year plan. I think it's a 5-year plan. I think by the time this governor's done, we're going to start seeing privatization in education going full tilt boogie because some of the entrepreneurs, they tell me they're entrepreneurs, they know private education is the way to go. That's where the big money is because that's where the billionaire money is.
Absolutely. When you send your kid to a public school, the public school has to be handicapped accessible. They have to have teachers for special needs students. They have to have gymnasiums. They have to have field trips. They have to have a criteria that is mandated by the state. They have to have testing that's mandated by the state. The private schools don't have to take those kids. If your child is handicapped and they don't have handicap accessibility, they don't have to accept you. If his grades aren't high enough, they don't have to accept you. They can say it's open enrollment, and they can say it however they want, but you check out the private schools, and you find how many handicapped children are there, how many kids with special needs are there, how many low-achieving kids are there. You're not going to find them. You're going to find those kids. They're not going to take them. They're going to leave them in the public school, and they're going to say, look how much better our kids are doing at private school today.
Let me ask you this, Scott Conklin. You've laid out the plan, and I think it's quite apparent. They have not been particularly quiet about their goals to destroy public education and to, you know, as Grover Norquist said, you know, drag government into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. They have not been quiet about that. How do we stop it?
The only way to stop it is vote. I mean, I know people, I'm sure you say this all the time. You've got to stick together. I mean, this, and again, I'm only using the governor. This isn't a Republican, Democrat, independent, non-voting, voting, whatever it is issue. This is about a long-term plan that is based strictly on greed. And greed is the worst denominator in government. Remember, the downfall of every nation has been overextension of military force and corruption of the government, which is basically greed. And for those folks who want to be Tea Party folks or whoever they are who may not be listening right now, but if you are, you're about to lose everything you're fighting for because we need to get out. We need to stop it. First off, you have to understand how government works, which is very difficult with all the different things that are involved in it. But if we do not stand up for working folks, we don't stand up for jobs, we don't stand up for our children, and if we don't educate our children, we're not going to be able to compete, and we're not going to have jobs. And that's what's so shocking about this governor. Cutting education for our children, at the same time he says he's business-friendly, he's not business-friendly. Business-friendly means you educate the workforce and you attract the manufacturer and you attract the businessman to come to an area. We're saying, guess what? We don't want to educate our children. We don't want high-tech. We don't want manufacturing. We don't want that because we're not going to educate our children. We need to get people back involved in this system again. We need to get people that understand that paying those $2 a month, I get my money from working people. I don't get my money from large corporations. I don't get one big check from an individual. My money comes from people that work, and it may be a $1,000 check from a Teamsters or a $500 check from the bricklayers. I don't see that as $500. I see that as every one of those guys laying a brick, throwing a couple dollars in a week to help me to represent them. And that's what we have to get back to, that we have to get back to a good, solid base and understand who really represents us and who is just blowing smoke. And when we do that, Rick, we're going to be able to change this tide again, but we need to change it quickly.
Last question I've got for you. I know you got to get back to fighting for folks. But here's the thing. Truth be told, do you need to even really be there today? Because as I'm hearing it, as I'm seeing it, the Republicans are not listening to anything you on the Democratic side of the aisle have to say. You've had almost no input. This budget, it's their baby. There are no Democratic fingerprints on this, as far as I understand.
There are none. And you know what? It's nothing more than a farce that you hear. They say we weren't involved. We weren't allowed in the room. They say, well, where were you coming up with money at? We did amendments to use the $1 billion surplus. $700 million is sitting there right now in an estimated $1.5 billion next year to try to fund these things. They said no. We put bills in to use the Marcellus Shale tax. They won't run the bills. You know, so when they sit and they tell you that the Democrats weren't involved, they wouldn't allow us in the room, and they shot down. They used procedural motion to keep these votes from going to the floor because these are good bills. And they knew their members that came to the floor, they would have to vote for them or they would be in trouble if they didn't. They used procedure. They've called the question more than I've ever seen in my life. They stopped debate. They do not want to debate. They do not want to talk about it. They want to run their agenda without the public hearing or saying what's going on. The reason we're still here late tonight, because our members have stood up. We're putting on the record exactly what they're doing. They can spin it any way they want, but it's still the same bad song.
Scott, I got to tell you, I don't know how you do it, but I'm thankful that you do. Keep up the fight, and you know what? Like I've been saying, today we begin the resistance started last November, but we've got to keep going forward.
Well, you know, what helps, Rick, is getting to call guys like Rick Smith and Venning, so thank you.
You've got the hotline number anytime.
Thank you very much, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right, Scott, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. Scott Coughlin, Pennsylvania State Representative. We're back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
It turns out that the rich are not so different from you and me, for we're all filled with anxiety. You and I are scared by what they're doing to our middle-class future, and they're scared of what we might do to them for what they're doing to us. The really, really richy rich, for example, are going to the dogs, literally, but they're not getting pooches at the adopt-a-pet shelter, instead shopping in the high-end guard dog market. This elite canine crowd is paying up to $400,000 for, quote, an executive protection dog. As I said, these are nervous people. The New York Times reports that one fellow who is wallowing in wealth laid out $230,000 for his exec protect dog, and he flies her by private jet between his Arizona and Minnesota mansions. He now has six of these security hounds, taking a couple of them with him in his car every time he goes out. Then there are some swells who fear that even a pack of attack dogs won't be enough if there's a mass uprising of knocked-down commoners. So they're seeking shelter to ride out any storm, paying as much as $20 million each. They're buying luxury doomsday bunkers. One of these retreats for elites, now being built under Nebraska grasslands, is practically big enough to have its own zip code. This project by Vivos, Inc., offers four levels of individual suites, medical and dental clinics, a fully stocked wine cellar, pool hall, its own little jail, and, just in case the worst comes, a prayer room. And yes, there are kennels if you feel the need to bring your executive protection dogs with you. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this fear would dissipate if these rich ones would simply join the rest of us to restore shared prosperity to our economy. As President John Kennedy put it, if a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Wake up in the morning, get to work and fight yourself. And then somebody tells you that you're over someone else. So what's it all about? It's funny! Work it out!
It is, and they've just stolen a whole bunch of it. You know, I gotta be honest, I'm hoping the citizens of this state wake up. I'm hoping they wake up tomorrow morning, they open up that newspaper, and they go, holy pile! I got screwed. Over on our Facebook page, Rob writes, to think the foolish T-publicans who voted for Tommy Boy swallowed his no-tax increase lies. Unless they're colossally stupid, and given their vote for Tom, they may be, even they will be able to do the math and figure this one out. I sure hope so, Rob. I sure hope that that folks tomorrow morning they start reading the reports, because I haven't seen an awful lot of really positive reports coming out. Oh yeah, he kept his pledge. The Republicans brought us in under budget. They cut. But start looking at education. Start looking at nursing homes. Start looking at granny, the disabled, the poor. Start looking at all of these programs. Who I'm telling you down the line. And as the Patriot editorial board said, short-sighted. When you start looking down the line and granny can't stay in her home anymore, she's got to go to the nursing home. Big, big, big expense right there. When you start seeing more remedial work needing to be done because you got 40, 50 kids in a classroom and they can't pass the standardized tests. More remedial work, more do-overs, more holding back. going to cost us more in the long run. And, Jake, I got to be honest, I sure hope someone grasps it, gets this through their thick skulls, especially those T-twits who keep going, I'm taxed enough already. Just wait.
And you haven't even mentioned firemen and police. I mean, there's a report coming out today at Harrisburg. Substantial cuts in the amount of money that the state's coming back for fire services. $112 million for higher education. Universities within this state have already announced they're eliminating departments. They're laying off professors. And what about here's a question. What about those students who can't take the classes anymore because their departments were eliminated? You don't think those students are going to be angry? I think the Republicans have underestimated, and we've said it before, but I truly believe it, the Republicans have very much underestimated the political cost of this.
Nope.
People will not forget when your son and daughter, and you're paying big money, Rick, to a university, and all of a sudden they can't get the education because of cutbacks by this administration, you don't think they're going to be mad?
Of course.
Oh, yeah, and they're going to be mad for a long time. They are going to pay for this. They are going to pay for this.
But the question is, do they just look, and this is where there's part of me that's starting to look at this and go, do they just look and say this is a failure of government or this is a failure of Republican-led government, conservative-led government, T-Twizzler-led government, this far-right, and there's some far-right Democrats as well, but what I've said from the beginning, in these instances right now, here in Pennsylvania, the Democrats are held harmless. They're held faultless here. Because they right. didn't have an opportunity, and who knows where they would have gone. But right now, this is a steamroller, baby, and it's coming right down the lane, right after you.
The Republicans cannot claim this was a bipartisan effort. This was not bipartisan. This was a steamroller job by one party that has complete control, period, end of sentence.
Greedy, no good. Speaking of greedy, no good. Bernie Madoff, evidently talking to the New York Times, he's complaining that the 150-year sentence that he got for his huge theft, what they're calling the biggest financial scam in the history of this country, he got 150 years, and he's saying, well, you know, it's excessive, you know, they're treating me like a human pinata. And he said, you know, maybe the judge felt, well, he's 70 years old, so even if I give him 20 years, he's going to be 90 years old. He said, but quite frankly, there's a big difference between dying in prison and, you know, dying outside with your family. Look, and what I love about this is the New York Times actually took time to write this story, worried about this guy who's going to die in prison. Do you think that they're going to write any other story about any other criminal dying in prison? The guy's a criminal. Pretty simple stuff. It was a ripoff from the beginning, and what we need to do is send more of these messages. I'd like to see more of those Wall Street criminals perp walked and given, here's another 150-year sentence. You remember some of the scam artists of the 80s and 90s?
Oh, yeah.
Michael Milken? If you gave him a 150-year sentence, do you think there would be anybody coming after him?
How about the savings and loans people?
Neil Bush.
Yep.
Silverado savings and loan.
Mm-hmm.
If you gave him a 150-year sentence, you think you'd see more of this? That's what's got to happen.
Yeah. Well,
and what you've got, and this is what really just tans my hide. Where did I come up with that? Tans my hide. That sounds very, very Southern.
Look at you being creative.
Look at me. What really, really flips me off is you got a guy like Darrell Issa, Republican congressman from California, who's the Oversight Committee chairman, stepping in and asking why the SEC is investigating Goldman Sachs. The SEC saying, hey, maybe they defrauded some of their investors. We're going to look into it. Well, he sent him a letter and said, hey, I want to know. He demanded to know if there was any sort of prearrangement, coordination, direction from, or advance notice between the SEC and the Obama administration or congressional Democrats. Because everything's political. The criminals on Wall Street have always got somebody in their pocket they can pay. And now you find out that after he sent the letter, bought some Goldman Sachs bonds, some of these Class A high yield fund bonds, worth about $50,000. So he's had a whole bunch of investments. Now, what they're saying with Goldman Sachs, he's got somewhere between $5.1 and $15.5 million. Is that motivation for him to step in and ask questions? You be the judge. But at the end of this, when you've got a congressman like this doing the bidding for a criminal corporation, what do you think happens? So, like we talked about last night, New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg, former Republican senator from New Hampshire, hired on as an international advisor for Goldman Sachs. Now we find out why? Well, they're planning on firing 1,000 workers, sending those jobs over to Singapore. We gave them $10 billion. And how do they thank us? Well, we're going to ship 1,000 jobs out of the country. We're going to cut $1 billion in operating costs, which means wages, so that those working people, they get screwed. I understand Goldman Sachs doing really well. First quarter of this year, $2.7 billion in their pocket, pure profit. Beautiful. Now they want to cut another. They want more because it's never enough. It's never enough. They want to be like GE and Chevron. They want to be like the big boys who outsource jobs and collect the dividends. Just amazing stuff. 2.4 million jobs over the past 10 years have been outsourced. And who benefits? The wealth class. Just like this whole debt ceiling talk. Personally, and we've talked to a guy in the past who has said, it's unconstitutional. I agree. I agree the whole debt ceiling idea is unconstitutional. We've got a debt. We've got to pay it. Simple. Simple. 14th Amendment written right there in black and white. Even a T-Twizzler could read it. But they're making a big crisis out of this. Why? Because they want to steal your Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. They want to destroy Medicaid. They want their pound of flesh. They want it now. And they're setting the table. They're going to destroy Medicaid. It's a done deal, I think. But what they're setting the table for is in a couple years down the road, they've already got us talking about, well, we need to rein in Medicare. Oh, Social Security's, we need to rein that in too. They've got us talking their language. Instead of saying, well, you know what? Maybe a good idea would be, heaven forbid. Like the president said today, maybe raise taxes on the very, very, very wealthy. There's an idea. But you go back to this whole debt ceiling thing. The Republicans during the Bush years, they loved raising the debt ceiling. Oh, boy, it's party time. When they controlled everything, when they were in charge, it was, hey, drunken sailor time. It was hookers and blow. They were partying like it was 1999. They raised the debt ceiling in June of 2002, $450 billion. They raised it in May of 2003, $900 billion. They raised it in November of 2004, another $800 billion. March of 2006, almost another $800 billion. September of 2007, $850 billion. Boehner voted for all four of them, all of them, all five of them. Boehner was right there. Cantor was right there. McConnell was right there for every one of them. McConnell, he voted against the first one, and they kind of talked him into the right direction. They kind of smacked him around a little bit and got him into line. Basically, they filled his coffers. And while they're raising the debt ceiling, they're handing out trillions of dollars in handouts to the people who don't need it. I mean, the May 2003 one is really one of those moments where you go, you raised the debt ceiling by $900 billion, and then you gave a massive handout of $350 billion to the very wealthy. You borrowed it and handed it over? Really? And now you've found Jesus, and you're going to preach about deficits and debt? Really? You hypocrites. Absolutely amazing. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this. 248 economists saying, we need this debt ceiling. We need it now. You're screwing things up, Republicans. We're right back after this.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
I gotta tell you, next November cannot come fast enough. November of 2012 cannot come fast enough for us to change what's going on here in the Capitol, here in Harrisburg, what's going on in Washington. You have got a party that is holding this country hostage. You have got a party that is, their mentality is scorched earth, crash and burn, whatever your choice of phraseology would be. They just don't care. Who they care about? Big corporations. Who they care about? Themselves. And you look at the fact that 248 economists, including six Nobel Prize winners, are calling for clean, immediate debt ceiling and increase. Now, immediately. They write, we, the undersigned economists, urge Congress to raise the federal debt limit immediately and without attaching drastic and potentially dangerous reductions in federal spending. They go on to say not doing so promptly could have substantial negative impact on economic growth at a time when the economy looks a bit shaky. In worst case, it could push the United States back into recession. Understand? You know, they had their little tizzy when Cantor decided he was going to storm out because he wanted to protect those tax breaks for the uber wealthy. He was waiting for the Democrats. He was laying in wait. You know, like a thief in the night. He was waiting. He was just waiting for them to say, we need to raise taxes on the very wealthy. That's the common sense position. We need to raise taxes on the very big corporations. That's the common sense. You know, we're talking about cuts, but you've got to raise some revenue as well. He waited for that moment. That very moment. And then came the charade, then came the theater, then came the theatrics and the play. He storms out, makes a big deal, and we find out they had been planning that for weeks. And look, the president today said, look, you got to get this done. Republicans, you got to get her done. But they're firm. They're firm on their position. We are not raising taxes on the wealthy. And I look at our stat of the day from the Tax Policy Center. They're saying about 24,000 U.S. taxpayers. We'll say 24,000. they make over $532,613. Puts them at the top 1%, because that's what gets you into the top 1%. You make over $500,000 a year. They're saying those 24,000 people who make greater than $500,000 a year will pay absolutely not one dime of federal income tax in 2011. Not one dime is what they're saying. Now, here's the reality. The reality is, and you can, this website, remappingthedebate.com, remappingthedebate.com, has a really great little tool. And according to the little tool there, in 1953, back during that socialist administration, folks who would have made $532,613 a year, each one of those 224,000 individuals, they would have paid, instead of the zero federal income tax they're going to pay in 2011, they would have paid $333,128. Take that together, that's right around $8 billion in tax revenue into the coffers. Now, you understand the past 30 years we have continually dropped it down, handed more to the wealth class, and taken less in services, less in education, especially higher education. Because what we've done is a masterful job of shifting responsibility from the state and from the nation to educate our children and our college students into saying, well, you know, you're an individual, take that debt on yourself and let that take it to your grave. But here again, these 24,000 people, you can put them in a pretty big size room. 24 grand, 24,000 people. $8 billion that we've left on the table. And, you know, here's the thing. Here's the thing that those, look, and this is what the T-Twits don't want to hear. The reality is that I would be paying a third higher taxes as well. So would you. People in the 50 to 75,000 range, you would pay higher taxes as well. Because back in the 50s, we invested in education, invested in infrastructure, we invested in the future of the country. And I think there was a willingness to sacrifice and say, you know what, we need a military, we need infrastructure, we need education, we need to go do the things that we were capable of doing. We invested in the country and we went to the moon. We invested in the country, we built a highway system. We invested in the country, we built the world's best education system. Then along comes Ronnie. We stopped investing. We started saying, oh, rich people, here's your money. Here's money. Here's some more. Oh, won't you please create jobs? And they said, wow, I got all this money? Oh, we're going to Mexico. We're going to Guatemala. We're going all around the globe. We're going to create jobs everywhere. There's business opportunity out there. We're going to take advantage of it. And they did. And they created millions and millions of jobs, just not here. And I look at the next lost opportunity. And understand, I'm pretty well convinced that we're going to lose this opportunity as well, which is the green energy, the renewable energy sector. We're going to lose this industry because China is eating our lunch. They're investing heavily. They're building plants as we speak. In fact, when Texas wanted to build a big wind farm, where'd we get the turbines from? That's right, the Chinese. And Google, the web giant, yesterday came out with a position paper saying that, you know what? If we don't do anything, if we delay action, this country could lose up to $3.2 trillion in potential domestic production, the GDP. We could lose $3.2 trillion because we're not willing to invest. And again, you know, I look at the country that is able to be energy independent, the country that doesn't have to deal with the Middle East, the country that doesn't have to deal with Venezuela, the country that doesn't have to destroy their environment. That's the country that's going to lead the 21st century. And the Chinese understand that, which is why they're investing so heavily into alternative energy. Solar panels, wind power, all of that, geothermal, everything. And the analysis that Google used said our need for energy must be balanced against the often competing interests of the economy, environment, and national security. They write, clean, sustainable, safe, and secure sources of energy are needed to avoid long-term harm from geopolitical risks and climate change. You know, someone who's willing to say global climate change. They write, unless fully cost-competitive with fossil fuels, the adoption of clean technologies will either be limited or driven by policy. Innovation in clean energy technology is thus needed to reduce costs and maximize adaption. Now, look, I've been saying this for the longest time. If our government would have said, you know what, we're going to put solar panels on every federal building. I need someone to build them. You would have entrepreneurs racing to start solar panel corporations. In fact, the people who are putting panels on my house, American-made panels from Arizona, that's what they did. Somebody had some demand. They found American-made products. Now they're moving forward. They're expensive because we're not doing it on a large enough scale. If we were doing it on a much larger scale, I think we'd be better off. But here's the thing. Their analysis really pegged on a couple of really key points. The fact that we could create somewhere around 1.9 million jobs. We could grow the U.S. economy by $155 billion a year in GDP just by having a clean energy policy. We could save consumers at least somewhere around $1,000 a year. And we could reduce our oil consumption by over 1 billion barrels a year. And what's that going to do for what's it going to do for our country? Well, it's going to do a lot of things. And more importantly, it's going to help reduce some greenhouse gases. You know, Jake, my kids, we go to the park, we go to the swimming pool, stuff like that, and they absolutely hate putting on solar sunscreen. Just hate it. Oh, my. And I don't ever remember doing that as a kid. And my wife goes, well, they hadn't screwed up the ozone layer yet. You know, every report you see now, my kids, if they, you know, went out in the sun like I did, I never really burned. But if they went out in the sun like I did, chances are down the road they're going to have skin cancer and who knows what.
Exactly right. Most experts claim that you absolutely do need that sunscreen. And your wife hit it on the head. She's absolutely right.
But they hate it. I mean, it's one of these things. That's the reality. But the reality is now, hey, welcome to life on planet Earth. We've screwed up some stuff. This is the reality. The question now becomes, how much more are we going to screw up? When do we stop? When is enough enough? And look, you know, you can believe in climate change or not. At the end of the day, it comes down to common sense. If I can get energy from the sun, that will go through my little panels and help me save some money and do that, why wouldn't I want to? You know, the people who really want solar panel are the folks who control the energy grids. They don't want to have to keep increasing the amount of energy that they're producing. They don't want to keep increasing the infrastructure. Now, we're living off of old infrastructure, which is why, you know, you go back a couple of years, the whole state of Ohio and Michigan and parts of New York and Pennsylvania were blacked out for, I think it was like a week or 10 days, because our infrastructure's in need of help. So by going to alternative fuels, by going to alternative resources, solar panel, wind, geothermal, you're not taxing the grid as much. Smart policy. But again, we got folks.
If you remember that the Blue-Green Conference we attended, I believe that was 08 in Pittsburgh, they were talking about just things like retrofitting buildings and emphasizing solar and wind power. The governor was all ecstatic about it. They claimed that we could create up to 4 million jobs, and now we find the wind turbines. Many of them are made in China. In a few short years, we've lost part of that. Why? Because we didn't have a commitment.
When we come back, we're going to talk about this Marcellus Shale thing. Question is it the boom that they tell us, or is it a bust? We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one,
call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
With the PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
I don't know if you saw this, but again, you know, in talking about energy, you know, to me, solar, wind, those are no-brainers. We should be doing those as a matter of course. Should have been doing it since the late 70s when we developed the technology. We should have been full force. I mean, just head down the road. We should have had building codes by now that say every roof in this country has solar panels installed on them. We should have just some sane policy. But again, what happens is it's a lot easier to say, well, you know, we'll just push that down the road. We'll keep using gas and oil and coal. And you look at the fact that, according to the AP, the federal mine disaster investigators have disclosed a few pieces of new information. They're looking at the Upper Big Branch mine explosion that killed 29 miners there in April of 2010. And they said, quote, that Massey's owner, the owner, Massey Energy, kept two sets of books. That chronicled safety problems. One, the internal set, that one that looked at production reports, detailed problems, and how they delayed the coal. Remember, the CEO said, when your foreman tells you, wrote in the memo, when the foreman tells you don't do anything but run coal, you don't listen. You just run coal because running coal pays the bills. And then there's the other set of books, which they present to the mine inspectors. And the ones that they give to the federal government, which failed to mention any of the same safety hazards. And these are the people that we want to police themselves. In fact, some of the hazards that were not disclosed are identical to the ones that contributed to the explosion. So had we enforcement agents, had we people looking into this, those 29 people may still be here. But you know what? We didn't, because during the Bush years, we gutted all that. It also goes on to say that portions of the Upper Big Branch mine hit by the explosion were not treated for excessive or explosive coal dust. Because remember, it's all about running coal. We don't need to worry about any of that there dust stuff. You know, it can't happen here. It also says that gas readings taken shortly after the explosion showed too little methane to support Massey's claim that a massive, natural occurring, and unpredictable inundation of gas caused the disaster. No, this was something that was a chronic problem. And here's my real concern. Those miners, I'll bet you they know. And didn't have the ability to say no. Didn't have the ability to turn around and say, you know what? There's something wrong here. We're going back. And the other thing that they say is the path of the blast that accompanied the explosion traveled in more complicated and convoluted ways than reported earlier. They say the details from a private briefing in Beckley, West Virginia, for the 29 families, bore that stuff out. And you know, you look at this and you go, again, another unnecessary disaster.
And if you look at the report, Rick, it says that only one has been indicted so far. And what is it, 18? Up to 18 of the former executives pleaded the fifth, including Don Blankenship. And if I can add one more, something that's real key, it was methane gas that was decided upon by the investigation, and they had methane detectors in there, and the batteries in there had to be changed periodically. And when you change those, you're supposed to mark it up. Well, they forged those documents. Here's the thing. If they would have reported it accurately, and the federal mine inspectors come in there, they could have possibly closed that mine down and had that fixed. But because there were false readings, it never came to the attention of everybody.
Yeah, because they don't care about the
people.
It's
criminal neglect.
There, and again, it goes back to what I've talked about in the past, about the idea of a benevolent corporation. They do not care about you. You are a tool. You're a cog in the wheel. Now, look, there are some decent employers. And I'm not going to say they're not. There are some good people. But the second you start costing them more money than you're making them, not so much anymore. And we saw that. Saw it in September of 2008. Saw it through 2009. Saw it in 2010. We saw people being kicked to the curb. Benevolent or not, it's business is business.
I'm glad to see the federal investigations have come in, because I don't trust the power structure in that state. Blankenship was known to exert huge political influence. He bought off more than one judge in that state over time.
Now, you look at what's going on in West Virginia with the Masseys and the Blankenships and all of these other coal companies. You look at what's going on. And you say, is Pennsylvania going to learn the lesson from West Virginia and from Pennsylvania's history? As we move forward with the drilling in the Marcellus Shale Field, are we going to learn those lessons to somehow restrain the rape and pillage? And part of me says no. You look at this budget. You look at the budget they ran through, cutting the Department of Environmental Protection at a time when the need for such oversight is greater and greater and greater and is only going to grow more in the coming years. Everybody admits that. This is a boom. There are going to be people sticking needles in the ground everywhere. And yet we're cutting funding to make sure that those needles aren't contaminating our drinking water. In fact, I just saw a report that somebody in the state is putting up signs, fake signs. PennDOT is not putting up these signs, but putting up signs to put a lighter to your spigot before you drink any water. Because, hey, you know what? You may have methane gas coming through. You may have a gas problem, and you may be drinking that. But you look at all the stories, and boy, you know, the story I read today out of the Patriot was just, you know, amazing. Boy, it's just the gushers in Allentown. Boy, it's just unexpected, but it's paying off. Big, you know, the people are leasing their land and they're happy as can be because they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars a month in royalties, and they're just doing great. And this, you know, these energy companies they're just tickled pink because boy, they hit a sweet spot. And they're able to suck out all this gas, and boy, everybody's just so happy. Oh, my goodness, they're so happy. And they're really happy because they don't have to pay any extraction tax. So that extraction tax that they pay everywhere else in the country, they put in their business plan, they are pocketing. But the big boys are in town. The Chevrons, the Exxons, the Royal Dutch Shells, they're in town and they're looking for profit. And the question is, again, you go back to the Massey story, and I think Massey's important. They failed to oversee what was going on in that mine. We're cutting the oversight body here. We are slashing their budget at a time when the industry is exploding. Who's going to protect the workers? They're not unionized. In fact, most of the people, and this is important, most of the people are not from Pennsylvania. Most of the people working on those rigs, they're not from here. So why would they care? A little spill, who cares? A little spill. Not going to affect my family. A little catastrophe. Screwed that up. We'll just cover it up. Let somebody worry about it down the road. And if you think I'm kidding, learn from the past. When you have transient labor, they don't care what they leave behind. What they care about is what they take with them. And this is why it scares me to have this industry exploding under our noses without people in the neighborhood. Because think about it this way. If I were to come and put one of these derricks in your front yard, you would care how that was treated, wouldn't you? You would care if the methane gas got into your water. You'd care where your kids were. You would care. Me, I live halfway across the country. I don't care about you or your family. I don't care a bit. My family's okay. That, to me, is important. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Riddle me this, Pac-Man. The industry is saying, we don't have a lot of Pennsylvanians working for us because they don't have the right skills. And they say they're waiting for our schools to train these individuals, these Pennsylvania citizens. At that point, once they're trained, is there any obligation for these companies to hire them on?
We've got thousands of, no, there's no obligations, there's no laws, there's none of that. But we've got thousands of unemployed construction workers, we've got thousands of steam fitters, we got pipe work, tin knockers, we got tons of people who can do those jobs. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers, the Teamsters, and the AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department are all weighing in against the proposed free trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia. The Teamsters say that these NAFTA-style trade agreements have cost nearly 2 million American jobs, and these proposed agreements just continue the trend. The United Steelworkers say these three agreements will undermine our economic recovery and further decimate American manufacturing. The AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department says the deals will contribute to the erosion of America's industrial base and are disastrous for construction workers. 800,000 federal workers could end up furloughed if Congress fails to move forward on an increase of the debt ceiling. Jesse Russell reports.
That's according to a study conducted by George H.W. Bush's former Treasury Undersecretary, Jay Powell, who crunched the numbers with assistance from Bill Clinton's former budget director, Alice Rivlin, and retired Senate Budget Committee Chairman, Republican Pete Domenici. The study, released Tuesday, reveals the U.S. government would be unable to fund 50% of its obligations. The federal government would need to implement an immediate cut of 44% in federal spending. Impacted departments include Veterans Affairs, Labor, Health and Human Services, Transportation, Education, and others. Military pay would also likely be on the chopping block. Powell told reporters that the end result would be chaotic. Republican presidential candidate and Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann has dismissed any talk of not raising the debt ceiling as being dangerous for the country as nothing more than President Barack Obama using scare tactics.
Harsh state budget cuts have been pushed by Republicans with the claim that cutting will grow the economy and jobs. Economist Adam Hirsch at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, though, says that data shows that's not true. In fact, states that increased their spending have seen more economic growth, lower unemployment, and more jobs creation. Hirsch looked at 24 states that cut spending and 25 that expanded government spending by an average of 11%. Hirsch says that states that increased spending on average showed a 1.4% rise in private employment, lower joblessness, and a half percentage point of real economic growth. States that cut spending on average saw a 1% hike in unemployment, a 2.1% drop in private employment, and a 2.9% real economic contraction rather than growth. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm gonna nominate this as the theme song for the Democratic Party. I surrender. That seems to be the thing that they're doing, especially when you look at these trade agreements. Man, I mean, the fact that Max Baucus is out there leading the charge on this just scares me to death. And nothing, I can't remember anything that Baucus has been in front of that has turned out well. And these trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea, I don't see turning out well at all either, even though everyone on the right and most of the Democrats are saying, oh, this is going to be a great thing. We're going to create jobs. I'm not seeing it. That's why I've asked Arthur Stamlosi, executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, citizenstrade.org, to come talk to us a little bit. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at these trade agreements, and to me, it's in big flashing letters, I see NAFTA.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is the biggest package of free trade agreements since NAFTA. And just like NAFTA, these trade deals are only going to make it easier for big corporations to shift jobs around the globe to wherever labor is most exploited, to wherever environmental regulations are the weakest. And that means, you know, more job loss for American workers. It means declining wages and working conditions both here and abroad. It means more environmental degradation. And, you know, and it means more power and more profits for Wall Street, the Fortune 500, Chamber of Commerce, those guys. But it means the rest of us are going to get screwed.
Yeah, and for me, it says I'm now competing with even more low-waged workers and people who will work in desperation situations.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. Colombia is the deadliest country in the world in which to be a union member. More union leaders were assassinated in Colombia last year than in the rest of the world combined. 17 have already been assassinated this year. A year when, you know, they're under extra scrutiny because they're trying to get this free trade agreement done. That's what free trade means to these people, you know, shipping jobs around to wherever, you know, workers' rights are suppressed so that corporations get access to cheaper labor.
You know, one of the reasons.
It's a lose-lose situation for working people everywhere.
Absolutely. One of the reasons I voted for President Obama in 2008, I sat no more than 10, 15 feet away from him when he said this.
You can trust me when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers, that they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
I'm not seeing the strong labor protections, and I'm not seeing that it's going to be good for us.
No, the labor protections in these three pending free trade agreements are labor protections that were added by President George Bush. Okay? These are protections that explicitly forbid the agreements from being used to enforce the International Labor Organization's core convention on, you know, the right to organize, banning on child labor, bans on slave labor. These deals do nothing to protect American jobs here at home. They don't protect workers abroad, workers' rights abroad. To suggest they do otherwise, I think it's just offensive, and no one really believes that they do.
Well, here's the statement he made today, is that the reason we have to pass this, and this is kind of the Democratic side of this, that they're pushing this idea. Well, we have to pass, especially with South Korea. We have to pass these agreements because they already have pretty much unfettered access to our markets. This is just going to open up access for our products to their markets. And I have two questions. One, do really the South Koreans and the Colombians and the Panamanians have free access to our markets? And if so, the other question is, what the hell are we doing that for? What happened to protecting this country first?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of South Korea, no, they absolutely do not. With Panama and Colombia, yes, there is some preferential access to their products, but those programs are geared towards things like coffee and bananas and flowers. They're not geared towards manufactured goods. And these trade agreements, you know, far more than just reducing tariffs, include all sorts of incentives for corporations to offshore. And to actually invest money overseas in creating new facilities, and so these are much, much worse than the simple trade preferences we have in place for, you know, for Colombia and Panama. And when it comes to South Korea, no, that's not accurate. This trade deal massively reduces tariffs for South Korean goods, and it's not just goods from South Korea. The rule of origin provisions in the South Korea Free Trade Agreement allows up to 65% of a Korean assembled product to be made up of parts from third-party nations like China, like Vietnam, potentially even North Korea,
or even Africa for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely.
But here's the thing, and you know, as executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, one of the things, maybe you can answer this, because the way I see these trade agreements, it's not about working people, it's not about me, it's not about the guy working on the factory line down the road here, it's about the big investors, and it's about agribusiness. We tailor all of these trade agreements so that our criminals on Wall Street can get richer, and the big, not the local farmer, but the big Monsantos and Archer Daniel Midlands, and these huge factory farms, they can benefit and really destroy, like we did in Mexico, the agricultural business in those other countries.
No, that's right. I mean, these ADMs, Cargills, these big corporate middlemen benefit from billions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer subsidies. They're able to sell things like corn and wheat on the international market for less than what it costs our farmers to grow it. And it puts literally millions of small farmers in these developing countries out of work. And in the case of the Colombia FTA, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to move into the drug trade, they're going to move into illegally armed groups, or they're going to move into the undocumented migration stream. I mean, those are the only options for people when the small living they're able to eke out for themselves and their families is taken away. And it's got nothing to do with free trade. I mean, this is subsidized agricultural products with our taxpayer dollars, not free trade. It's about corporate profits at the expense of people.
Yeah, here's the thing. What's going on now, the messaging that's behind this, hey, you know, times are tough, the economy's down, we need to create jobs. These trade agreements, this could be the answer. You got the Chamber of Commerce and President Obama and Max Baucus all walking arm in arm. Hey, this could be it. If we don't do this, we're going to put American jobs at risk. That's what Tom Donahue said, the head of the terrorist group over at the Chamber of Commerce.
I mean, even the federal government's own International Trade Commission has said that the Korea Free Trade Agreement is going to increase the overall U.S. trade deficit. That means net job loss for this country. They talk about exports, exports, exports. They never look at the other side of the equation, the imports, and the fact that these trade agreements, you know, NAFTA, CAFTA, the WTO, have massively increased the U.S. federal trade deficit, the deficit that's, you know, far more responsible for inequality, for job loss in this country than the budget deficit. And these trade deals, I mean, American public knows these trade deals are job killers. You look at any public opinion poll, it shows that. They're not fooling anyone with this. The problem is that they're answering to Wall Street and the chamber, and they're not answering to their constituents.
You know, at the end of this last night, we talked about the number of containers coming into the country. The Journal of Commerce, they said that, and this just blew my mind, that the Chinese send 717,000 containers of finished product into this country every year, and the next closest importer is Japan with about 50,000. We are just being crushed by foreign competition. We are just being crushed by this insane idea that we can open up our markets to everybody else and have these agreements that really don't help us.
Yeah, no, these trade agreements are going to make that dynamic much, much worse. I mean, the Korea Free Trade Agreement, Korea is a large economy. It's the 12th largest economy in the world. Passing a NAFTA-style trade agreement with South Korea is going to have NAFTA-style effect on our economy. Big, big job loss, wage stagnation for sectors of the economy that aren't vulnerable to offshoring. This is a serious problem. And, you know, we need to hold our elected officials accountable. That's the bottom line.
How do we stop it?
We need people to call their members of Congress and tell them we've had enough. You know, hell no, we can't put up with any more job-killing free trade agreements. We're obviously hoping the president's going to step back from the cliff on this, choose not to introduce these deals. There is some opportunity for him to save a little face and do that because of the stalemate right now between the White House and Republicans over job retraining benefits for displaced workers. But we really need Democrats and others in Congress to speak out against these trade deals before it's too late. And that means calling them, emailing them, getting up in their faces at town halls now, you know, this week, next week, before the votes are over.
Yeah, I go back to the last election in November of 2010. And, you know, you had a lot of people run on this T-Twizzler platform where, you know, America first, you know, kind of all that stuff. I'm curious, and I haven't heard a lot yet, but I'm curious on where those newly elected freshmen, you know, the far-out right-wing Republican freshmen, where they're going to stand on this. Because I got to be honest, I thought they were, you know, America first, we're going to defend America. And these agreements, I'm sorry, just not seeing that.
Well, that's a very good question. And unfortunately, it looks like most of them are going to be towing the party line and going with their party leadership on this, which is, you know, hugely unfortunate. But you're right. A lot of the Tea Party, freshman Republicans did run on an anti-offshoring message and an America First message on a, you know, no more free trade agreements message. Some of them will do the right thing and vote against these deals, but unfortunately we're expecting most of them are going to go south.
You know, the one question I do have for all of them, especially on the Republican side of the aisle, is if this is a job creator, if this is everything that they say it is, at a time when we need all these jobs, why not just pass the trade adjustment assistance? If we're not losing jobs, what harm is it going to be to have protection just in case?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a fantastic point. And, they know. This is going to displace hundreds of thousands of American jobs, and, you know, they don't want to pay for it. So that's why they're opposing it.
And, again, it goes back down to the reality is I don't know that they really give a rat's behind about the working people of this country. It's all about the people who fill their campaign coffers.
I mean, there's certainly anyone who supports these free trade agreements is doing so at Wall Street's behest. I mean, no one after 15 years of NAFTA can credibly argue that these have been a good deal for America, American workers. Something needs to change. And it starts again with people calling their elected officials and saying enough's enough.
And, of course, going to citizenstrade.org. Of course, we've got a link at our site at therixsmithshow.com. Just click on Arthur Stamlosi's name. It'll take you right there. Arthur, great talking to you. I appreciate it. Keep up the fight. And as this moves down the road, we'd love to have you back.
Well, thank you, brother.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It turns out that the rich are not so different from you and me, for we're all filled with anxiety. You and I are scared by what they're doing to our middle-class future, and they're scared of what we might do to them for what they're doing to us. The really, really richy rich, for example, are going to the dogs, literally. But they're not getting pooches at the Adopt-a-Pet shelter. Instead, shopping in the high-end guard dog market. This elite canine crowd is paying up to $400,000 for, quote, an executive protection dog. As I said, these are nervous people. The New York Times reports that one fellow who is wallowing in wealth laid out $230,000 for his exec protect dog, and he flies her by private jet between his Arizona and Minnesota mansions. He now has six of these security hounds, taking a couple of them with him in his car every time he goes out. Then there are some swells who fear that even a pack of attack dogs won't be enough if there's a mass uprising of knocked-down commoners. So they're seeking shelter to ride out any storm, paying as much as $20 million each. They're buying luxury doomsday bunkers. One of these retreats for elites, now being built under Nebraska grasslands, is practically big enough to have its own zip code. This project by Vivos, Inc., offers four levels of individual suites, medical and dental clinics, a fully stocked wine cellar, pool hall, its own little jail, and, just in case the worst comes, a prayer room. And yes, there are kennels if you feel the need to bring your executive protection dogs with you. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of this fear would dissipate if these rich ones would simply join the rest of us to restore shared prosperity to our economy. As President John Kennedy put it, if a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, some interesting numbers. You remember when the president was, he was talking about the high cost of our presence in Afghanistan? Remember that? That's the reason we need to bring our troops home. He said it would cost upward of $1 million, upwards of a trillion dollars for the wars. And the reality is he's way, way off. And according to Brown University's Watson Institute for International Studies, their piece Cost of War, which was released today, says the final bill could be as high as $4.4 trillion. What they're saying is in the 10 years since we've been warring, we've already spent between $2.3 trillion and $2.7 trillion. According to the study, now this is amazing to me. According to the study, that estimate, that $4.4 trillion for our Warren, does not include at least $1 trillion more in interest payments that we're going to have to pay over the next God knows how long it's going to take. And the many billions more in expenses that we can't figure out, which, you know, we have no idea of really estimating how much it's going to cost to fix the broken soldiers, the wounded soldiers, the people who are missing arms, legs, or minds. And again, you know, as I said right from the very beginning, my only hope in all of this was that we learned the lesson from Vietnam and did not do to this generation of heroes what we did to that generation, which was leave them and really just dump them back into society, especially in my neighborhood where I grew up. But, you know, the study goes into some interesting numbers, which, you know, you start looking at the casualties and you go, you know, American losses over 6,000, 6,051 by conservative estimates, some 2,300 contractors, U.S. contractors, near 10,000 Iraqi security force people, and you go right down the list, 125,000 Iraqi civilians, which I got to be honest, I think is really kind of low. Just the enormous number of people who were injured. And I mean, the costs are just staggering. And yet, what did we get for it? And I mean, that's really the question. You know, so as we're talking about cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting Medicaid, slashing the education budget, slashing the public welfare budget. What did we get for our, you know, if you look at the numbers, some $5.5 trillion that we're on the hook for? What do we get for it? And that's the question, man.
Iraq. I saw some studies several years ago, and they're talking again, and that study doesn't include the very long-term cost. Just for the Iraqi war, and again, you hit it on the head. Some of the costs that really haven't been incorporated into that is the long-term cost of taking care of the wounded and taking care of those who have severe mental and emotional problems. It is going to cost this country a fortune. And they had estimated just in Iraq, Rick, long-term, just in Iraq, between $3 and $4 trillion, massive costs, and I think it's the greatest military mistake in the history of our country. We should not be there. And I still, to this day, this is just me, I still believe we were deliberately, by the Bush administration, misled. I truly do believe that. Because the neocons who controlled that administration, back in the 90s already, they wanted to go into Iraq. In the late 90s, they were making public speeches about why we should. Once they got control, they found an excuse. They didn't find a reason. They found an excuse to go in, and here we are.
Well, I mean, you go back to the whole, the whole Bush thing. And the reality is, you know, he said from the beginning, man, he wanted to go in. He wanted to have a successful presidency. He wanted to be the guy. He wanted to, you know, get, like his father screwed up, he wanted to learn all of those lessons.
Well, you know, his father did advise him not to go in, and the big reason was Junior didn't have a policy of getting out. Never did, and here we are.
Well, like, you're gonna,
it's gonna be a quagmire, you're gonna be bogged down, don't go in, and here we are.
Well, you know, and again, you know, the reality is that Dick Cheney knew from the beginning. He absolutely knew that you couldn't go in there and not have to, he knew. Bottom line.
I mean, there's so many things that they did that they have not been held responsible for. And Dick Cheney, to me, was the brains between those two, was the brains, and yet for the first time in history ever, when the intelligence agencies, and this is the story that came back, when the intelligence agencies of the United States and Great Britain brought the information back, the way it works, they get the information, they bring it back to the Congress and the administration, and then they decide what they want to do with it. But he was at these debriefing minis, and they said anything that could vaguely point to a reason to go into Iraq, he emphasized. Anything that was negative, he tried. In other words, he tried to spin it. And that's the first time that ever happened. You were supposed to have an intelligence agency, gave the information, but they tried to, for lack of a better word, filter it through their political prejudices.
And it was all political. You know, because if you remember, Cheney knew.
Do you think that U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had, but for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
I think we got it right. That was him in 94. 94. He knew. You don't go in there. What are you going to end up with? What did he say? Basically, you break it, you bought it. What are we going to put in its place? It'll splinter. Mm-hmm. Remember all that? That's what he just said. Mm-hmm. He knew that. And yet, this was a highly political war.
And remember, Schwarzkopf was of the mindset to go, and the president said no. And I think they did make the right choice. I think, if you remember now, the Iraqi army, this was in the 91 invasion, Iraqi army was pretty sizable back then, and they would have incurred a lot of casualties on us if we would have went into Baghdad. No question about that.
Amazing stuff. But again, the question is, was it worth it? Was all of that funding worth it? I personally don't think so. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ken Bissonnette from Talk Radio News Service. Right back after that.
This is why we fight, why we
for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
The following message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aging. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseloads, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our senior citizens suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We are AFSCME.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the globe. Ken Bissonnette, Talk Radio News Service. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. The president had a press conference today.
He sure did. It appears he actually heard Senator Bernie Sanders' plea earlier this week to practice some shared sacrifice in this contentious debate over deficit reduction. The president laid down his marker in the showdown with the GOP. He argued that without removing tax breaks for things like hedge fund owners, oil and gas companies, corporate jets, it may mean taking scholarships away from college students, cutting back on medical research, and, of course, curtailing health care for the elderly. Of course, the Republicans, they're unrelenting. They refuse to give an inch. The reaction from Speaker Boehner right away was, you'll never get this through the House. But there's plenty of time between now and August 2nd. President also, threw a curveball at the Republicans when he basically said, hey, let's get this done, or maybe we don't take a vacation this summer. And it's not an empty threat. The president can call Congress into session.
And he should. I mean, this is that important.
The interesting thing was a lot of people on the left, as you probably know, didn't think the president would go this far. Now, it's just words right now.
It's a start. It's a start, man.
Well, it is, and it's a. I think it's a good start because if he decides he wants to sell this, it might not be that difficult to sell removing a tax break from a corporate jet owner who's making millions and billions anyway.
Yeah, and I don't think it's hard to sell the idea that someone who made the right bet on Wall Street shouldn't pay only 15% capital gains tax, while somebody out busting his behind in the hot sun building a house or working on a road crew is paying more almost twice that.
Right, right. And, his language was really interesting. I think he hit on some really good, as you know, he can hit the speaking points. He said, when he laid this down, he said, and I'm quoting here, I don't think that's real radical. I think the majority of Americans agree with that. For those of us who pay very close attention to this man's words and the linguistics, what exactly they mean, that is actually a signal that I'm going to sell this. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to sell this. And with the right amount of pressure, I mean, he might actually be able to woo some people who see eye to eye more with the Tea Party than anything else.
Yep.
At some point, people are going to have to shift and take a step back and say, government is not the beginning, middle, and end of all evil. There are other problems, and we're working our tails off. We don't necessarily have to align ourselves with the Koch brothers and this stuff that they're selling us.
Well,
and, that's yet to be seen, but it's doable. It'll certainly have to be doable between now and next November in the larger picture.
So let me ask you this, since, in talking about the press conference, since, you seem to read into some of the things he says, what do you think he meant in talking about the Boeing and NLRB case when he said we can't afford to have labor and management fighting all the time? Because I got to be honest, I'm not seeing labor fighting. They're the ones getting beat up in all of this. So I'm not sure where all this fighting is coming from.
I'll tell you exactly what it means. I went down there for some rock and roll last year, late last year, down to North Charleston. I've seen that neighborhood, and I just want to let you know, I consider myself to be third generation organized labor. I was in the Wire Service Guild when I was with obviously with the Wire, and my dad was with a small operation called the Teamsters, and my grandfather was organizer in the textile mills in Fall River, Massachusetts, where I grew up. So I consider myself a brother of the labor movement. But I will tell you this. There are people down there who need jobs as much as anywhere else. And yes, while they're not going to get the same wage, that they probably would get up there in the SeaTac area, Seattle and Tacoma, where Boeing is mainly based, there is an argument to be said that in this economy, jobs are essential. And I've thought long and hard about this NLRB ruling. And, probably 5 years ago, I wouldn't have this conversation with you. I wouldn't take this point. I think the president is basically signaling that on this one, he is not going to go to the mat with labor. You're absolutely right. Labor has been taking a beating.
I got to tell you, you start taking that mentality.
Mm-hmm.
There are places in this state where we need jobs just as bad as anywhere. There are places all over this country. So basically what the argument then is that you're making, and I'm not going to beat you up over this too much, but this is a zero-sum game. You're taking jobs that we're going to be put in a different area, and you're moving into a different area for a lower wage. That's in essence the argument that you're making, because they need those jobs. Well, they need them in other places as well. So instead of creating jobs, which they're not doing,
mm-hmm.
They're taking those jobs from somewhere else. And it's been the economic development of this country. Instead of creating new jobs and developing new industries, we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and stealing from everybody else.
I can't debate one bit of the argument you just made, but of course, you're a guy in Pennsylvania and my roots are in Massachusetts. We're from organized labor states with deep organized labor roots. The only thing I can tell you is I would much rather see those jobs at unionized or not unionized down in North Carolina than in Taiwan or Korea
But here again, given that choice, doesn't it then highlight the failure of our trade policies and the failure of this this country to protect itself?
Absolutely. It's gotten so out of control that, you know, two pro-labor guys right now are having a debate, who are on the same side, when in fact the real problem is the folks on the top who make these extraordinary salaries and then get these mega bonuses. It's the same thing. I mean, it's the argument with sports. The athletes are paid crazy salaries compared to what their job means in terms of society.
Right.
However, compared to the profits that the owners were making, well, I understand. Well, you know what? Why they make that move? I guess we're just going to have to see how this thing plays out. No one wants to hear my next line, which of course is, let's let them put the plant down there. And once they're in, there's nothing that says they can't unionize. Now, the other thing is...
Well, other than a governor who has said she's going to do everything she can do to use the power of the state to stop that.
That's true. However, you know, we're also having a debate after the fact, which is the National Labor Relations Board has ruled.
Well, they haven't ruled. They've come out with a... They're moving along in the process.
This is going to be a long process.
Hey,
listen, I think that... All indications are the direction that they're going to go in is probably in favor of the workers, in favor of labor. I have no reason to believe that the NLRB is going to rule in another direction. Barack Obama will not work against the union. In other words, he won't go to the mat to say,
right.
You know what, I don't care. All I care about is the jobs. He will stay on the sidelines, potentially.
Yeah, I see it going the other way. I see as we move down the process, as it goes through the court system, I think the court system is pro-business enough that they're going to say the investment that Boeing's made is too significant to uphold the law. So, yeah, they broke the law. We'll slap them on the wrist. Because at the end of the day, South Carolina does not matter. They could have moved those jobs to Pennsylvania. They could have moved them across to California. It's about Boeing coming out, and I didn't even want to get into this, but it's about them coming out and saying we moved because those people went on strike. It's a quid pro quo. It's retaliation for people standing up for their rights. And the question then becomes, do we in this country have the right to strike? That is the core message. That's the core question here that has to be determined. Let's move on. I mean, we could argue this for days, I think.
Yeah.
Let's get to something.
Your points are well made, and it's an uncomfortable argument for me to have to make. But I've been down there. I've seen the plant. I've seen the people in those neighborhoods, and I was moved by it.
Yeah, I've been to Detroit, Michigan.
I know what you're saying. And you know what? The man saved those jobs in Detroit, didn't he? You know, he bailed out the auto industry, and he saved a lot of jobs there. So he hasn't gone completely south on the whole idea. There has to be, in the larger picture, if I may just have one more comment on this.
Sure.
Based on what the president said, it cut both ways. Management has to do something. My feeling is this. If you will pay a wage and give benefits that don't justify a union, more power to you. I no longer believe in unions just for the sake of unions. I believe in treating people respectfully, giving them a good wage, giving them the benefits they need. If Boeing's going to behave like that, then I think that, you know, it's up for negotiation. One thing that I would love to see is Boeing step up and say, okay, there's not going to be a union there. We're going to do profit sharing. If they were to do something like that, boy, that makes a real, that's still pro-worker. You don't have to be unionized to be pro-worker.
I agree with you on that. But in this case, this whole moving of the, I got a real problem with it.
No, I hear you, man. You made your point, and I heard you, and the wheels are spinning in my head again on this. So, you know, point well taken.
Let's talk about something really important.
Yes.
Michelle
very
Bachmann.
Important.
Michelle Bachmann. What'd she do today?
Oh, man. It wasn't today. It was the second day in a row. She's having a tough time sticking to that script, as you know.
Yep.
One day after she linked John Wayne, the actor John Wayne, to the serial killer John Wayne Gacy. You probably have talked about this a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, the newly crowned queen of the Tea Party made the gaffe, you know, when she defended her statement that the founding fathers worked tirelessly to end slavery. You're up in this, I assume.
Yep.
It's unbelievable. I'm a Massachusetts guy.
It's amazing.
For her to pull this, not know the difference between John Quincy Adams, who she said was a founding father. At best, he was a founding son, right? Yep. Gets caught on that. She was absolutely right when she said that he fought to eradicate slavery many decades later, you know, after the founders were shaping the Constitution. Point being, she could have gotten out of it. Stephanopoulos was great. He gave her an out.
Yep.
And instead, she comes back with, well, he was very active when he was a child.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
In the womb, you know, in the womb. I mean, he was older than in the womb, but in the womb, yeah, he was.
He was a child.
He was,
you know, I know that much about it. But the point is, you know, Bachmann isn't obviously the only Tea Party celebrity who doesn't know her Revolutionary War history. You know, the woman Bachmann deposed as the queen of the Tea Party, Sarah Palin, as you know, recently suggested that Paul Revere, in his historic ride to warn that, quote, the British are coming, close quote, did so to warn the British. Now, as a Massachusetts
firing
guy,
shots into the air.
Yeah, yeah. As a Massachusetts guy, can I just ask this rhetorical question?
Yeah.
Is it too much to ask that people associated with something called the Tea Party actually know what was going on during the era of the actual Boston Tea Party? I mean,
no, it's not too much to ask. But you know what Bachmann also did do in the interview with Stephanopoulos is she basically undermined the entire, because there's a part of the Tea Party that believes in this original intent idea, this original intent of the Constitution, and we should stick to it strictly.
Yeah.
There should be no changes. And this is what she said when Stephanopoulos asked her about, you know, the Constitution and the whole thing. And this just completely debunks that whole originalist mentality.
You know, what's marvelous is that in this country and under our Constitution, we have the ability, when we recognize that something is wrong, to change it.
Right there, just threw it right out the window.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And, you know this, but this original intent, where does that come from? That is borrowed from their extreme fundamentalist views of what? The Bible.
Yep. It's
amazing, isn't it?
But it gives you an easy argument. If you don't like anything that's happened, you can always fall back on, well, you know, back to what the founders said. I can't name more than two or three founders, but what he said.
Yeah, no, that's it. And it's, and of course it's, you know, the whole cafeteria style constitutionalist. They don't want to talk about separation of church and state.
Well, the jailhouse constitutionalist, if you will.
You know, I mean, it is quite breathtaking.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Ken, always great talking with you. Ken Bisonette from the Talk Radio News Service. I appreciate your time, brother.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I will be back on Tuesday, so how about letting me wish you and your listeners a happy 4th of July?
All right. You do as well. Great talking to you, man.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All right. Now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. We talked about earlier in the show about how this $27.2 billion budget was passed tonight. Of course, the Republicans are putting a big spin on that. Some of the spokespeople are saying, well, it was a necessity, and we held to our original ideas on the budget and our promises to the taxpayer, and others are saying, well, it's going to create jobs. I thought it'd be interesting to look at the reality of what their budget will do. For instance, in education, the Pennsylvania University system is facing about $112 million deficit. The chancellor of Pennsylvania State University system says it's facing its biggest ever, let me repeat that, its biggest ever financial challenge as it board prepares to set tuition rates for next year throughout the state. Chancellor John Kavanaugh told members of a board meeting Wednesday that the system faces a $112 million deficit, mainly because of the loss of more than $90 million in state and federal money. That's $90 million in state and federal money. Again, they're going to have to cut back. Not only are they $90 million short, that means substantial number of jobs are going to be cut. Some universities are actually cutting departments. And it's going to have a very negative effect in a lot of places throughout the state, and once was a great educational system, but this is definitely going to hurt. Article in Harrisburg again concerning another negative effect. The Pennsylvania budget cuts payments to Harrisburg for fire services. The state's payment to Harrisburg for fire services provided to the Capitol Complex is budgeted at about $496,000, roughly half the near $1 million being provided this year. The city was spared a similar cut last year when State Rep Ron Buxton, Democrat from Harrisburg, landed a $500,000 community revitalization grant for the city with less money for legislative grants. And the Democratic caucus in the minority, Buxton, this time has not been has been unable to secure a similar save. The city budgeted $987,000 from the state, so the immediate impact is a near $500,000 negative. The city is facing a $3.1 million deficit. Now, that's still another blow. The fire services payment is the state's largest annual direct payment in lieu of taxes to Harrisburg. State government facilities, by the way, are exempt from local real estate taxes. So the city of Harrisburg, an immediate cut in fire protection. And again, that will probably result, Rick, in some of the paid firemen being laid off. Funding cuts, Dauphin County, Human Services. We talked about the programs that were going to be cut on a statewide and on a countywide basis. This is another example as a result of the horrendous budget that was passed tonight. An impending $4 million cut in funding for Dauphin County Human Services programs will leave those services in survival mode, according to County Commissioner George Hartwick. The county will receive about $53.8 million in state funding for such programs in 2011-2012, according to a budget adopted by the county commissioners. County and federal support will bump the county's total annual human services spending to about $87 million. The county expects to pump an extra $1 million into these programs compared to the 2010-2011 funding. The drop in state support comes as the county struggles with long waiting lists for some programs, especially mental health services, according to Hartwell. Let me repeat that. The drop in state support comes as the county struggles with long waiting lists for some programs, especially mental health services. He said county officials have been seeking savings and have saved about $4 million in the last 2 years by focusing on community-based programs instead of institutionalizing clients. Even with these practical changes, there's still going to be a huge shortfall for the county of Dauphin. What does that mean? That means that a lot of at-risk people in this county are going to be without those important services. And when you're talking about mental health, that's very, very key. And again, the people who run these programs, some of them are going to lose their job. So this accusation by the Republicans, this assertion that somehow it's going to create jobs, is absolutely false.
I think it's going to create jobs. I'll tell you where. All those folks who are living in their homes, who are on the borderline, soon could possibly end up in a nursing home, they're going to the nursing home. We're going to need to hire more people that. The poor folks who are, you know, they need health care, like the guy that robbed the bank recently, just so he can get some medical attention. Maybe we'll start seeing more of that. Prison population going to go up. Understand, the governor's budget increased the prison budget because I think he understands. That's a pretty good sign that he gets it. We're going to cause, by these deep, drastic, draconian cuts, we're going to cause more prison population, and you got to pay for that.
Well, on a corollary issue, Rick, the irony is they've increased the budget for the state police by 6%. Why? Because they need substantially more cadets going through their training system. Why? Because many local municipalities can't afford police anymore. So what happens? By default, that covers has to be conducted by the state police, and that means substantially more cadets. So the irony is he did create jobs after he lost a lot of jobs over here. By sheer necessity, he has created some jobs.
Yeah, we will see. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up right back after this.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike. Call him at 243-3211. You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too. So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings. That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. My name is Michelle Bachman. I stand here in the midst of many friends and many family members to announce formally my candidacy for President of the United States.
I guess her supporters are not going to stop believing, but the folks over at Tom Petty told her, don't use my song anymore. Katrina and the Waves, don't use my song anymore. Stop it, you're crazy! Today she came out, she said, you know what? I'm not going to get into a mud wrestling fight with Sarah Palin. I got to be honest. I think I'd pay for that. I think I would pay to see a mud wrestling. I would absolutely love to see a mud wrestling fight between Michelle Bachman and Sarah Palin. As much as I'm not really big fans of theirs, politically. And again, send me all the emails you want, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me that I'm sexist. I'm not.
I guess the big question is, who's your money on?
I don't care. I don't. I'm hoping that Sarah Palin fights dirty. Let's not go there. Good news coming out of Las Vegas today. You've got to somehow... Begin to fight back some of this stuff, but some good news coming out of Las Vegas. The reality being, the Teamsters are having their convention, and they just put out a press release. Delegates of the 28th International Brotherhood of Teamsters Convention unanimously approved a resolution to prosecute chief executives and other Wall Street criminals, players, responsible for the global financial crisis of 2008. One of the General Secretary Treasurer, Tom Cagle, says, how come not one single Wall Street CEO has gone to jail after destroying the economy? He said, we demand that Wall Street pay for the crisis. Now, they passed this resolution. It's called the Putting Working Families First, Make Wall Street Pay resolution. And it goes on to say, look, you got to help. You got to help folks first. You gotta prosecute these criminals, all of the CEOs and the Wall Street players who did this. We need a rescue package for working people, their pension funds. We need to help get folks who are having trouble with their mortgage, help them out. And we need to, help restructure these banks, so that they're helping companies who are struggling. And one of the examples they give is YRCW, formerly Roadway Express and Yellow Freight Company. They need some financial help because, look, at the end of this, that company especially, a company that employs 25,000 some good-paying job folks, it's one of those moments where the bondholders and the wealthy could just let them go out of business and still benefit from the insurance on the bonds. It's just it's perverted.
On so many, if I can just add to that, and we covered it tonight, but I got to say this. I would hope that eventually those who were responsible for the death of those miners, I hope they answer. I really hope the feds pursue that. How can you justify those deaths of 29 miners? And no matter what happens, Rick, if they wind up in jail the rest of their life, it will never replace what those families have lost. Just criminal. Absolute criminal behavior.
Yep, I'm right there with you. The other thing that before we go, and we're at the end of the show, and I just someone sent me the letter that John Boehner, Boehner, sent to everybody saying that a tax hike cannot pass the House, and, quote, it's off the table. The American people know taxes aren't the problem. Washington's spending binge is the problem. And they truly believe that they're going to stand by their what they believe the last election was about. So we are headed down. We're playing chicken. The Republicans are playing chicken with the economy, playing chicken with the health of our credit rating. And really, at the end of this, it could mean some cuts for Social Security. If they default on this, we're going to pay our other obligations. And grannies all across the country, there's a possibility. If the president doesn't claim it's unconstitutional, that Social Security could see a whack. Just amazing. Anyway, I want to thank our guests tonight, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, and, of course, Scott Conklin, and, of course, the executive director of the campaign trade, the campaign trade people over there. Thank them as well. Again, you know, there's just so much going on. This budget, these trade deals, the debt ceiling, all of this stuff that the Republicans are on the wrong side of again. Wrong side. Wrong again. Wrong policies. Wrong ideas. Wrong direction. I guess, you know, just going back to the W's. Anyway, I want to thank everybody. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and download our podcast. And you can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.